Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk about Medicaid expansion. There was a day of events across the Commonwealth. We're going to talk to the experts, the people who are working on this day and night, and also the people who, someone who would be affected by this. And you remember when our governor took office, you know, the governor of the people, one of his first acts as governor, kicked some 41,000 working people off of adult basic, a very, very modest health insurance program to cover the working poor. We're going to talk with one of those 41,000 people who was booted to the curb. Also going to talk about guns. It looks like the gun thing done. The senators, I believe, have given up. We tried, but it's not going to work. So while the Senate has given up, I say that it's time for the people to rise up. And we're going to hear from an activist who has been shot, and her best friend shot and killed, and she's working to make sure that some reasonable, rational, sane regulations are in place to keep guns out of the hands of those who, well, would do harm to, well, like her. Also, education. We're going to talk a little bit about more the bigger push towards corporatizing and profitizing our public education system, and especially privatizing. Got to get that money. Money, money, money. And big news, the immigration bill is out. Can't wait to see what's in it. I'm sure lots on guest workers because we need cheap labor. More HB1 visas because we need more cheap labor. And, of course, more handouts for big corporations because, well, that's what we put in every bill. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So have you been following the two big stories of the day? One, in Boston, you've got the photos of two more suspects for the Internet to go crazy over. And hopefully we find these people and we bring the people responsible to justice. I'm still holding my judgment on who it is. I have a lot of friends, I have people who have told me, hey, I'm sure it's Al-Qaeda. I'm sure it's those. Even though no one's taken responsibility for it yet. But we've got this certainty that that's who it is. We've got it in our head. That's who it is. And I try not to be in that vein because while you're looking for that, chances are you miss who it really did it. So I'm going to hold judgment, and I hope that I'm confident that they will be found and justice as much as can be in a situation like this hopefully will be done. All the other big story, my view, another one of these big stories down in West Texas. According to their mayor, around 35 people now. It's up to about 35 people who were killed in last night's explosion, including 10 first responders. And I think, you know, it was a good thing it was at night. If it had to happen at night, it was probably the best time. Because, you know, within 2,500 feet of this fertilizer plant, do you remember the Oklahoma City bombing? Fertilizer, one of the main components. This is the plant that makes that fertilizer. So within 2,500 feet of this massive potential bomb, you have a middle school, a nursing home, and a hospital. The middle school reduced to rubble. The nursing home, the West Rest Haven Nursing Home, heavily damaged. Some 133 residents wheelchaired out. No report on any fatalities there. But, you know, you go down the road a little bit, at least 50 houses were damaged. A 50-unit apartment building, according to one state trooper, was reduced to, well, a skeleton. Looked like the Oklahoma City bombing. They report structures as far as a half a mile away, destroyed. Not just damaged, destroyed. One of the councilmen in the West Texas area said, for four blocks around, the area was totally decimated. The blast had the magnitude of a 2.1 earthquake. Felt as far as 45 miles around. And you look at this and you go, one, How did it happen? Two, my bigger questions are come down to why is this kind of a plant? Why is this place within 2,500 feet? And the middle school was within 1,000 feet. The nursing home was within 1,000 feet. The hospital was out on the 2,500 feet. So why is it that you have a middle school, a nursing home, and a hospital that close to a potential meltdown? For me, it comes down to the zoning laws. But look, in Texas, they're business friendly. You can prop up a business anywhere you want. Do business because it's your right. It's your right to do business where you want. And, you know, as I'm reading this story, as I'm looking at this map, and I'm looking at everything around this facility, I'm thinking, you could live in that neighborhood. I could live in that neighborhood. And is it my right to start something? And you hear this all the time. It's my right to start the business that I want. And I should be able to do with my land what I want. And as my grandfather always said, you know, you have the right to do whatever it is you want until your right infringes on my right. Or as Justice Black said, you know, your right to swing your fists around ends at the tip of my nose. Both perfectly accurate. And I look at this and I go, you know, this is why we have zoning laws, and this is why we have regulations, and this is why we have inspectors. The other part of this is the inspection process. We find that the last time this place had been inspected was more than 5 years ago. There's a lot of things to this. I mean, you look at the first responders, a huge story on that part. How's the screw question gonna play into all of this? You know, there was a fire at the plant. The fire call started at 7:29. You had the firefighters there. You had the first responders there. 24 minutes later, boom. They're saying right now at least 10 first responders dead. These are the people that we wanna screw with this sequestration. These are the people that we want to defund. These are the people we want to take resources away from. Because, hey, we can. Does it make sense to you? Because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So now you've got all of these people who we have said that, you know, we don't really value because we want to cut their pay. They're still out there at this moment searching for people to rescue, hoping that there's someone still alive, methodically and meticulously going through all of this debris, all of this rubble, to find who they can. And I think about having this plant right where it's at, within hundreds of feet of the population, hundreds of feet of average everyday people, who probably don't even know what's going on in there. I saw the video that was shot where the father's, you know, videotaping the fire and the little girl's going, shouldn't we get out of here? Shouldn't we leave? Get me out of here. Please, get me out of here. Please, get out of here. Daddy, please get out of here. I can't hear anything. And here's him. Oh, we're going to take some video. The kid got it. Why are they so close to this? Another woman was with her son at the school. They were just playing. They saw the fire. They started to walk away. Walked down the tracks away from the school. Boom. Blew the kid 4 feet in the air and broke his ribs. And, you know, I start looking at this and I go, you know, why? Why is this in that area? This calls into question why we need zoning laws. Hasn't been inspected in more than 5 years. And, you know, I got to be honest. I was surprised to hear that it had been inspected in that period of time. Because in Texas, according to some of the reports that I've seen, their inspectors have been so badly defunded, systematically defunded, systematically destroyed, politically destroyed. It would take 67 years for a state inspector to inspect every single plant, like the West fertilizer plant there. 67 years. 67 years. And you stop and you think about all of this. As we've seen agencies like OSHA defunded, as we've seen agencies like the NLRB defunded, as we've seen all of this oversight taken away because, hey, we need deregulation because we need to get regulation out of our lives. It's bad for business. Because, you know, if an inspector comes in or the regulator comes in and looks around, that, well, we're going to have to make sure things are right. And you think about the last number that we've had in 2010, more than 4,500 people were killed on the job in 2010. And that's up from the year before. We're heading in the wrong direction. And why is that? Well, it's obvious. It's because we've been cutting. And you look at the sequestration. OSHA is going to see its budget cut by over 8%, which is just another cut over the last 30, every opportunity. So now what you're going to see, because of the sequestration, because of the screwquestration, you're going to see 1,200 fewer workplace inspections. So you know what? More opportunity to do this. More opportunity to have these situations. So when this kind of thing happens, I hope it wakes somebody up to realize that, well, not every accident can be avoided. Most can. And we should be doing what we can to make sure. I mean, 35 people are not going to go home, are not home today. 35 families are without loved ones. I saw a number upwards of 175 to 200 injured. To the degree of injury, don't know. But for me, it comes down to sane, rational policy. It comes down to, should we have a fertilizer plant within a couple hundred feet of a school, within a couple hundred feet of a nursing home, within 2,500 feet of a hospital? I don't think so. Sad, sad stuff. They're in our thoughts, they're on our minds. And I hope this happens to no one and nowhere near us. I'm going to take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science. Well, don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Seven Florida teachers are suing the state over a 2011 law that they allege is violating their constitutional right to due process and equal protections. The complaint claims that by eliminating tenure for new teachers, but not for older teachers, it creates an unequal class system in the schools. Additionally, under the law, job performance is gauged partially by standardized tests, and those tests can include information that teachers didn't teach in the class. For example, the standardized test could include testing on math topics that the teacher being judged hasn't taught in her classroom. The Florida Education Association also joined the lawsuit, which was filed Tuesday in Gainesville Federal Court. The AFL-CIO is substantially expanding its non-union worker program, Doug Cunningham reports.
Working America, the AFL-CIO community affiliate consisting of non-union workers, is expanding to all 50 states in the U.S. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka told The Nation magazine that Working America has recruited more than 3 million people who aren't in unions to join the labor movement. Working America Executive Director Karen Nussbaum says the expansion into all 50 states will also mean beginning to organize in workplaces. Working America plans to double its number of state chapters over 3 years, with the goal of having chapters in every state by 2018. Nussbaum told The Nation magazine she wants to give workers the tools they need to get into motion at the workplace and in communities. She said labor leaders have told her they need Working America in every state. Working America is supported financially by the AFL-CIO, but the organization is working on economic self-sufficiency as it expands the number of chapters around the country.
More Republic Allied Waste workers have gone on strike, charging the company with unfair labor practices. Workers in Memphis and Millington, Tennessee, stopped collecting recycling, alleging that Republic unilaterally cut wages without negotiating with the union representing those workers. According to the Teamsters, some workers saw their paychecks slashed by upwards of $200. The strike follows workers in Georgia walking off the job Monday, alleging that Republic has refused to bargain fairly over a contract. Additionally, workers in Youngstown began an unfair labor practice strike on March 27th. Republic workers in other areas of the country have also stopped work in solidarity with those currently making the unfair labor practice charges. Strikes have been reported in Washington State, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Indiana.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need a budget that employs simple honesty for the common growth of our commonwealth. We must continue the journey that will turn the road to recovery into the path to prosperity.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So starting January 1st, no more pre-existing conditions. Understand that. So the need for these high-risk pools, remember yesterday we talked about the Republicans going ballistic. Oh, we're going to save the pre-existing condition insurance plan, the We Need to Help Sick Americans Now Act. Remember that? We talked about it. And I said, you know, it's kind of amazing. The Republicans are so hell-bent that we're going to save this. It's a good thing because it's one of the main parts of Obamacare. Something that they're supposed to be against, something that they're supposed to want to repeal. And we thought, hey, well, it's not a bad thing. Maybe the Republicans are coming around. Well, the big money hath spoken. The Club for Growth has come out with a letter to Joe Pitts, the guy who wrote the legislation that would have, well, extended this program for people with pre-existing conditions through the end of the year until the first of the year when pre-existing conditions are against the law and are outlawed. Well, Club for Growth not happy. In fact, their Vice President of Government Affairs, Andy Roth, wrote, fiscal conservatives should be squarely focused on repealing Obamacare, not strengthening it. Huh. Wow. So screw you people with pre-existing conditions. Our ideology says we don't want it to work. And Mr. Roth says if high-risk pools are needed to be established, they should be created and maintained at the state level by good for-profit corporations. Wow. The for-profit corporation, my add to that. It just blows the mind. Anyway, a day of action across the state as part of Obamacare, the expansion of Medicaid under discussion, and we're pushing for it for our governor to do it. That's why I've asked Athena Ford, advocacy director at Pennsylvania Health Access Network, PAHealthAccess.org, the website, to come talk to us about today's day of action. Athena, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you for having us.
So I understand your group held actions across the state. Tell me about it.
It was an exciting day today, Rick. We had actions in Philadelphia. About 200 people came out, probably a little bit more, marched from City Hall down to the governor's office to call on him to move forward with the expansion. In Pittsburgh, there were 65 folks out in front of the Bill Mazeroski statue because, you know, Pittsburgh folks, and it's a win-win when it comes to Medicaid expansion for us. We had good turnout as well in places like Scranton, in the Lehigh Valley area, in Erie, in State College, in Bucks County, and I hope I'm not forgetting any. But in all, there was about 8 actions across the state. Great turnout, obviously a lot of enthusiasm for the Medicaid expansion. And for folks who weren't able to participate with us today in person, because as you know, this is going to benefit a lot of working people who aren't always able to take the day off of work and go to an action like this.
Right.
They participated as well by calling their lawmakers.
Absolutely. Call early, call often. Because you're right. Most of the people who are uninsured are the working poor, are working people, and a large number of them. How many people do you estimate in Pennsylvania are uninsured at this moment?
My organization uses a slightly more conservative number. We've been saying it's about 1.2 or 1.3, but the Hospital Association recently came out with a study, and theirs was much higher. I think it was closer to 1.7 million. The point is, it's a lot of folks. And the other problem, of course, is that we're losing two people every day in the state die because they don't have health insurance, not because of what is making them sick.
Yeah, and the thing is it's not just the underinsured, the uninsured, it's the underinsured as well. I mean, we've been saying for a long time, 50 million people in this country uninsured, 100 million were underinsured because even the people who have the lower end policies, they're not truly covered either.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about the crappy program that a lot of folks who lost Adult Basic got pushed into, special care, that gives you 4 doctor visits per year and maybe $1,000 worth of diagnostic testing, and I think that's it. I don't even think it covers hospitalization. And if it does, it's a small amount. But there's a lot of plans like that that don't come close covering what Americans really need when it comes to taking care of themselves every year.
Yeah, and I look at this, and while I'm not a huge fan of Obamacare, I do think it's a step in the right direction, and every day I think we should be working to make it better. But, you know, come January 1st, when people are going to be eligible for these insurance plans, when pre-existing conditions are gone, I think this is a step in the right direction. And for me, it shouldn't be, your health shouldn't be whether you have a job or with an employer who offers health care or not.
Absolutely. And that's one of the biggest problem with our health care system right now is that if you don't happen to work for somebody that offers health insurance benefits, then unfortunately it's very hard to get access to the system. So in 2014, a lot of those restraints are gone. Folks can go ahead and purchase health insurance based on their income, not based on their pre-existing conditions anymore. I agree. This is a starting step. We need to expand. We need to bring back a public option. We need to make sure that we take the Medicaid expansion and continue to move forward from here.
How much is the Medicaid expansion? What would it cost? What's the federal government giving us? What's it going to cost us?
Okay, so that's a great question because we hear opponents of health care reform don't want to see us take the Medicaid expansion, right, because they want to see Obamacare fail in Pennsylvania. So they often say that it's going to be too expensive. We just can't afford it. It's going to cost about $4 billion. The truth is that the majority of those costs, Pennsylvania is going to have to spend anyway because the law mandates things like, well, we're going to give Medicaid coverage to, for example, for kids who turn 18 in the foster care system. They can stay on Medicaid until the age of 26, just like kids can stay on their parents' health insurance until the age of 26. We have to streamline different administrative procedures and enrollment, et cetera, and all of that's going to cost money. The bulk of the costs of the state costs Pennsylvania is going to have to spend anyway. It's going to be less than half of that we spend on just the actual expansion, and we're going to end up making so much money back from that. The federal government gives us $43 billion to do this Medicaid expansion. And, you know, you think about it, you take $43 billion and you inject that into our economy, we're going to end up creating lots of new jobs. We're going to be able to cover 700,000 Pennsylvanians with health insurance, which means 700,000 Pennsylvanians are going to be going to the doctor, going to the hospital. So they're going to have to hire new staff.
Yeah,
they're going to also, the folks that change their sheets are going to have to hire new staff. Then you've got the restaurant across the street from the hospital that hires a new restaurant worker because there's more folks going in during their lunch break. I mean, it's going to end up creating jobs. Actually, we estimate that if we accept the Medicaid expansion in 2014, that by 2016, we'll create another 40-some thousand jobs. And it's going to lead to an economic revenue boost in this state of about $5 billion. We're also going to save taxpayers $848 million. That's the low estimate in money that's otherwise spent in uncompensated care costs. So really, I mean, not just the right moral thing to do. It makes a lot of economic sense for Pennsylvania as well.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, for me, it's about getting people care. I mean, at the end of the day, for me, it's about if I lose my job tomorrow, if I'm unemployed tomorrow, if I get sick, and then a couple months down the line, I lose my insurance, should I lose absolutely everything I own? I mean, see, that's where I'm at the baseline. Just because someone gets sick doesn't mean that they should lose everything that they've ever worked for and end up out in the street. And a couple years ago, we had done one of our Hungry and Homeless for the Holidays events. And I met a guy who had worked his entire life up until he was about 45. He had a heart attack, lost his job, ended up losing his insurance. And by the end of it, here's a guy who'd worked every day of his life. But just because he got sick, had this one ailment, he was homeless. And he was living with me in a cardboard box for the week, had nowhere to go.
Yeah. I would love it if that was an unusual story, but unfortunately with the way the healthcare system is designed, it's all too common. And that's been a very important point when it comes to the Medicaid expansion, is that the way it's designed in the law, there's not an asset test, which means that if you lose your job, this is a safety net that will be there for everybody.
Now, this is just, what if you still have a job? What if you're at the lower end of the economic scale? Are there qualifiers that will help you get insurance? How's this all going to work?
Okay, so for the Medicaid expansion, it's going to be strictly income-based.
Okay.
And that's going to be, it's going to be at 138% of the federal poverty line. What that works out to, realistically, in 2014, it's going to be about $15,400 for an individual. Or if you're a family of four making around $31,800 a year, then you'll qualify. And I think it's important to look at the fact that most jobs that pay in that range don't offer healthcare benefits. So if you're a pharmacy technician and you're a mom of two, you're making about $24,000 a year, you'll qualify for this. The job descriptions we're talking about, home healthcare workers, hairdressers, pharmacy technicians, child care workers. These are the people that are struggling right now. They're working important jobs. We depend on these people to take care of our children and to serve us food, but they're not getting health insurance, and they're certainly not making enough to purchase health insurance in the private marketplace. So depending on their income, these folks will either then go into the Medicaid expansion or they'll qualify for the more generous subsidies available on the money exchange. That will depend on, like I said, on their income and on their family size. But the way it's supposed to work is starting October 1st of 2013, there'll be one website they can go to. They can fill in how much they make and what their family size is, and they'll find out right away what it is that they'll qualify for and be enrolled in real time into those programs instead of having to wait a couple weeks for all the paperwork to go through,
right,
et cetera.
So where is our governor on this? I heard some, you know, there's rumors going all over the place. I mean, I believe he's not going to take it. I think he's dancing around to try and figure out how to not appear as though he's not going to take it and blame something else. Where is our governor at on this?
You know, we're more hopeful than that. We think that he's going to come around. Right now, unfortunately, he's been saying he's still not sure about this, and he's trying to find a way to make it work. As you know, he met recently with the HHS Secretary, Kathleen Sebelius, and they talked about, you know, ways to make the program a little bit more flexible for Pennsylvania. Whatever little tweaks or changes it is that they need to do, we hope that they get that worked out and we move along with this quickly, because we really need to get this rolling so that we're able to actually start enrolling 700,000 people in the near future. I mean, there's a lot of processes, obviously, that need to start getting together and getting in place for all this to happen. The governor has been reluctant to move forward, but I think with Ohio's governor, Kasich, moving forward, with Rick Scott moving forward, you have Chris Christie moving forward with this, Jan Brewer, and it's putting, I think, a lot of pressure on our governor, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, Pennsylvania, almost all the states that surround Pennsylvania are moving forward with the expansion. We're about to be an island of the uninsured here.
Yeah, well, don't worry. Scott Walker in Wisconsin will make sure that that doesn't happen. Because, you know, I look at Corbett, and I think he's trying to be mini Scott Walker.
I don't know really what it is he's trying to do. I know that it's probably one of the least popular decisions he can make, and that's saying something for this governor.
So let me ask
you this. The Medicaid expansion is extremely popular, even among conservatives. That's why today, standing alongside us, we had both Democratic lawmakers and Republican lawmakers standing with us today. Because nobody wants to see Pennsylvania leave $43 billion on the table.
Yeah. But you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, what's bothering me about this is this drawing out, this drawing towards the deadline as we move closer and closer to October and as you move closer and closer to January. To me, it looks like this, a stall delay tactic so that we get down to the end of it and people have a nightmare trying to navigate this stuff. And they say, see, it didn't work.
Right. And this is too important to mess around with. These are people's lives that we're talking about. We need to step forward, do the right thing. And folks who are listening really should call the governor and should call your lawmakers and tell them just that.
And how do we do that?
I'm sorry?
How do we do that? Do you have a link at your website, pahealthaccess.org?
We do. We do. And you can also just, if you don't do it through our website, then you can go ahead and just look up the number by Googling the PA legislators. Unfortunately, we don't, because Harrisburg doesn't have a switchboard or something like that. We don't have a direct number. Folks will actually have to take about a minute and a half to look up their actual legislator with their four-digit extension zip code and find the number. That takes a minute and a half. Making the call makes 30 seconds, but the impact is blasting. I can tell you today I was hearing people were emailing me and telling me that lawmakers called them back personally.
Wow.
To say, okay, no, don't worry about it. I am supporting the expansion. I mean, these calls are having a real impact in Harrisburg. So please, folks, keep them up.
Make the calls, make them early, make them often. Athena, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the work that you do, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks so much. Athena Ford, Advocacy Director at Pennsylvania Health Access Network, pahealthaccess.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about TrustArc's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth Day cometh, the 43rd year of this national focus on our globe. Should we weep or cheer? Both. The first step toward any recovery is admitting that we have a problem. In fact, beaucoup of them. For example, despite the squawking of profiteering polluters and professional deniers, our very atmosphere, without which everyone and everything is dead, is rapidly being degraded by our addiction to fossil fuels, literally altering Earth's climate in disastrous ways. Yet, as we burn, our policymakers fiddle. Let us fiddle with the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, they demand, uncaring about the vast amounts of ozone-destroying carbon that will be released by ripping open the boreal forest to get at the junk oil, or about the extra carbon dioxide contamination that will come from processing this especially toxic sludge. Also, let us fiddle with the earth itself by fracking deep underground shale to bring gas, oil, and ozone-depleting methane to the surface. Oh, and let us keep fiddling with the priceless ecology of America's ancient Appalachian mountains by exploding off the mountaintops, merely to make it cheaper for big coal to extract more ozone-killing ore. There are plenty of horrors to make you weep on this Earth Day, but tears don't bring change. That comes only from the determined effort of ordinary grassroots people to organize, strategize, and mobilize. The good news for our Earth and our own existence is that such people are on the move in every part of America. They're confronting the greedheads and boneheads, creating effective energy alternatives, forging fresh and sensible policies, lifting heads out of the sand, and producing the change we must have. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what Earth Day is about. Don't weep. Cheer the progress we've made. And join the movement for more. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
No, no education for you, little girl. No. No health care for you, low-wage worker. No. But you know what he's good at saying yes to? He's really good at saying yes to tax breaks for big corporations. He's really good at saying yes to the charter operators and the drillers. Good at saying yes to them. You, me, working people, our kids, not so much. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So as I said earlier, our governor back right when he took office kicked some 41,000 low-wage workers off of the very minimal program, Adult Basic. Following the right-wing attack, the Alex stuff, because you go to Ohio, they got rid of Buckeye Care. You go to Wisconsin, they got rid of Badger Care. Well, just following the playbook, Corbett dumped 41,000 people. My next guest is one of those people affected by Governor Corbett's decision. She was also out today at one of the events for the Pennsylvania Health Access Network's Day of Action. Karen Campanello, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, no problem.
So tell me, you were one of the 41,000 people who, before the governor took office, on the Adult Basic Plan, correct?
Right.
And what's it been since, how have you been since the governor destroyed that plan?
Oh, it has been terrible. Me and my husband both have health problems. We tried to get insurance on our own, but with our pre-existing conditions and my husband's age, it's over $1,100 a month they want.
$1,100 a month?
Yes.
And what were you paying under the Adult Basic?
$72 a month.
So you were still paying something. I mean, because a lot of
right.
people think, well, you were getting this wonderful gold-plated health care off the back of the taxpayers.
No.
so much.
No.
And you work for a living, correct?
Right. We have our own small cleaning business.
Okay.
You know, and we've been doing it for 19 years. You know, and it's just, we don't know what to do, you know. My husband has problems with his knee and his shoulder. I had trouble before the Adult Basic was, you know, they let it go. And I had been getting treatments on my foot. But I had to stop that. So instead of just one of my right foot hurting me, now both my feet do. You know, and there's nights we come home from work and just cry, you know. But there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I saw your statement, and one of the things that caught my attention, you said we've gotten up every morning facing the reality that it doesn't matter how much pain we're in or how badly we need to get badly in need to get treated, we're
right.
uninsured, and that's the end of it. And you know, the sad thing is, for too many people in this state and too many people across this country, that's the reality every day.
No, it's terrible. Nobody should have to go through that.
And, you know, a lot of people, Karen, say, well, you know, if you're sick or if you've got these problems, you just go to the hospital. You go to the emergency room. They treat you, right?
No. You know, I heard that, you know, unless you're dying, you know, they kind of send you away. I had told Aaron, you know, I had called an orthopedic surgeon, you know, to see my husband about his knee. You know, he works hard. but I called to see, and they refused to take him because he has no insurance. They wouldn't even see him, you know. So what do? You know, I mean, he could go to the hospital, but they're not going to take care of it.
No, they're not going to do that. That's not life-threatening, because what most people don't realize is it's got to be something that you're going to die from right now before they'll take care of you. If you've got a long-term chronic ailment, you're on your own.
Yes. Oh, I know. That's why I said I don't know what to do. I said I'm so mad. You know, I keep thinking about, it was 2-3 months after we lost our adult basic, when Governor Corbett had an article in the newspaper about his back surgery, and that he put it off and he just couldn't take the pain any longer. You know, so he went in and had the elective surgery. You know, we don't have that choice. You know, we can't do that.
Yeah, I think I remember that, and you know, the fact that he couldn't stand the pain anymore. And I'm going, well, you know, when you've got the best doctors in the state, and you can rush to the head of the line. Yeah, you make that choice.
And we, the taxpayers, are the one paying for his surgery. You know that we aren't eligible for.
So how's this Medicaid expansion going to help you and your husband and your family? I understand you have children as well. Are your children insured?
We have 2 grown daughters, and then we have a 10-year-old son. He is covered. He's on the chip.
Good.
You know, but I said, you know, I have high blood pressure. My husband has high cholesterol. My mother passed away at 51 from, she had a stroke, you know. And my high blood pressure, you know, I tried to, I'm on a generic that I've been on for years. Well, they've raised the price from $28 a month to $96. A month.
Wow.
You know, I know. It's terrible. So my doctor had tried to put me on an $8 generic, and my blood pressure kept going up, you know. So I have to take what I have, you know. It took a long time to find one that would work for me.
And you know Karen, the thing that gets me, Karen, is, you know, you hear a lot of, we need to get rid of Obamacare. And for me, the whole idea of having an insurance plan is that we prevent things, that we get a lot of preventative care, so that if you've got high cholesterol, if you've got high blood pressure, you get treatment early so that you don't have a stroke, you don't have a heart attack, which costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. And for me, if we can treat something with a couple of bucks here or there to help prevent these problems, that seems logical, it seems rational, it seems reasonable, but I guess there's not an awful lot of profit in that.
I said it's terrible. I mean, that's like my foot. You know, when this happened, it was only my right foot, and now it's supposed to be, you know. I mean, it would have been cheaper to fix one than two, you know. And with the, you know, the blood pressure and the high cholesterol, and, you know, it's just my husband. He's, you know, worked hard, and, you know, he comes home and he's hurting at night, you know, and he can't sleep because he can't get comfortable, you know, and then we get up the next day and start all over again, you know.
Yeah, and the sad thing is, Karen, is your story, you're not alone. There are so many people out there that I've met over the last couple of years that have told me the same kind of stories, that they get up, they work their behinds off, but the reality is it's just out of reach. And we need to figure out how we put that solidly in reach. And it's not something, in my view, it's not something that should ever be tied to employment. It should be something that is a natural right of being a citizen, that if you're sick, you get care. That seems reasonable to me.
Me too. I hope they do something quick, you know.
So you were out today at one of these rallies. What do you want to tell people? And, you know, because, you know, I look at this Medicaid expansion, which seems fairly rational to me, seems like a decent idea. Let's make sure that everyone gets covered. Make sure that the folks at the bottom, they get the coverage that they need, so that everybody has this safety net. What do you tell people?
That's why I don't know. Something has to be done. You know, I mean, the money's there, you know. I don't know why he doesn't accept it.
Well,
you know?
According to some of my Tea Party friends, we're broke. There's not a dime in the country. We're going to be Greece in a couple of days. The end of the world's coming. So sorry, Karen, you and your husband, you can't have health care because we need tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires.
That's about it, too. You know, I wish I had an answer. I don't know. You know, 2 years ago when they let the adult basic go, I thought it would be something quick that they would, you know, find something and we would be covered.
Yeah,
you know?
They did something really expensive with a lot of profit motive involved in it. But I think you're doing the right thing. I think getting out in the streets, getting active, telling your story that others can identify and identify with, and maybe they'll come out of their homes and maybe they'll come out of their shells and take to the streets and say, you know what, we demand this and we demand it now.
Oh, that's right. We do. I mean, we need to do something, and everybody's got to work together to get it done.
I'm with you. Karen, I appreciate the time. I wish you the best of luck, and hopefully that this gets pushed through, gets passed through, that you and your husband get the health care that you need.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Earth, sky.
Researchers have learned that the toxins that make snake venom deadly can evolve back into completely harmless molecules.
This discovery could lead to new drugs for life-threatening conditions including cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure.
The toxins in snake venom evolve in a special gland in the snake's body. They start out as harmless compounds that have been doing different jobs elsewhere for the snake. In fact, a snake's venom gland appears to be a melting pot, a place for evolving new functions for molecules. Some of these molecules are retained in venom for killing the snake's prey. Others go on to serve new functions in other tissues in the body.
The idea that there are many harmless versions of venom toxins throughout a snake's body suggests a new avenue of drug development. X-venom compounds might be valuable because they're made up of what scientists call bioactive proteins, which already are naturally designed to target metabolic processes. And that's precisely what you need drugs to do.
So studies of deadly snake venom might lead to better human health. These scientists published their study in the journal Nature Communications in late 2012. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. For more stories about the human world, visit us at earthsky.org and follow Earth Sky Science on Twitter.
Search snake venom at earthsky.org for more on this story. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Eric Cantor says that he's bent on making sure that they repeal Obamacare in response to the Club for Growth's attack on the Help Sick Americans Now Act. Because now your Republicans want to save part of Obamacare because they understand politically people want it. But the moneyed people are telling them no. And this is really the push-pull back of what's going on within the Republican Party. There are things that the party knows we've got to do because people want guns, health care, jobs, you name it, down the line. People want certain things. Republicans dead set against it. Immigration, people want it. Republicans dead set against it. So Cantor's playing an interesting line because the Club for Growth is saying, don't you dare put that $4 billion into extending that health insurance plan for those people with pre-existing conditions. Screw them. They can wait till January. Because people like it. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this now that the money has spoken. Yesterday, Max Backdoris, the Democrat from Montana, the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and person kind of responsible for Obamacare, he said that he feared that the rollout of this would be a, quote-unquote, huge train wreck, which I found interesting considering this is the guy who single-handedly derailed single-payer. But he's worried that it's going to be a huge train wreck because all of these states and all of this stuff not happening as fast as they thought it was going to happen. The rollout. Look, here in Pennsylvania, they don't have the basic infrastructure for October, I don't believe. And we're just talking a couple of months away where, as Athena pointed out earlier, 1.2 million people would be rushing to those websites, would be rushing for those forms. And as Athena said, upwards of 1.8 million people in this Commonwealth. So, I mean, look, work to be done. Pressure to be put on this governor and these Republicans who are dead set. Look, it's the Republicans, and I hate being partisan, and I hate going, it's them. But it is. It's them. It just is what it is. Ron sent me an email during the break talking about the explosion in West Texas. He says, I'll bet you the area has a city ordinance that prohibits locating an adult bookstore within 2,500 feet of a school. Nudity, no. Explosives, yes. And I'll bet you there is. I'll bet you there's an ordinance that says no adult bookstores near a school. But you know what? Fertilizer plant going to explode, level the school. Yeah, build it. Build it. Beautiful. Jeez. More good news on the infrastructure front. Chicago is kind of trying to catch up with Harrisburg as Sinkhole Central. A sinkhole sucked up three cars today, injuring one person. One woman said she watched her car just go into the hole. One guy was injured when he tried to rescue his car. They're saying that it was most likely a water main break and the heavy rain that washed away, that eroded the under the road. And let's not forget, the sewage that hasn't probably been updated, and Chicago's probably a little older than Harrisburg, right around the same time that all this stuff was put in, probably 100, 120 years old. So there you go. Again, more of this stuff that we have not been investing in. And look, in Obama's 2014 budget, while there's some things I don't agree with, he is putting $8.8 billion into a fund for an infrastructure bank. Not a huge fan of P3s, but this is going to get some money into building roads and bridges, help our transportation, help our energy, help our waterways. It's going to, I think, be a step. And again, it's these steps. It's baby steps, but it's still steps. And speaking of baby steps, my former congressman, Bud Schuster, was at an event. He was speaking at an event sponsored by the National Journal when he said, quote, "We're not at the point where we're going to have two competing companies online in the Northeast corridor. He said, there are baby steps we have to take to bring the private sector into the operation of it. He's talking about Amtrak, whether it's operating the equipment, whether it's operating the personnel on the train that sells the tickets. There are a lot of different ways to bring the private sector in. Now, understand, Bill Schuster is the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee chairman. He's saying, I'm not going to go full bore, full tilt towards privatization. No. Not going to push for complete privatization. No. Want to do this in bits and pieces. So we're going to knock off the most profitable pieces first. Think about this for a second. We're going to sell off the Northeast, the most profitable part of it. So the nearly $1 billion that Amtrak gets in funding or this passenger rail investment and act with this $1 billion in operation subsidies, what this is going to mean, you're still going to pay $1 billion in subsidies, but the privatized part is going to take a good portion of that. And what's interesting to me is you look at the railroads. And just last night we talked to our good friend attorney Erwin Aronson, who pointed out that, you know, the railroads were private. The robber barons owned the railroads. Remember? Go back in your history, remember? The robber barons owned them. Then they ran them in, literally ran them into the ground. Didn't invest in them. And, well, they said, well, we need a whole bunch of money, or we're just going to shut it down. Well, in comes we the people to rescue it because, hey, it's a common good. We need to move things around. We need to a lot of things. So we put a boatload of money into it, and we save it. Now that it's back to being profitable, well, now the profiteers want it back. They want their stuff. More importantly, they want their money. And now you've got good Republicans who are saying, you know, hey, we'll give it back to you. All that taxpayer investment be damned. The public good be damned. It's all about the private sector. It's all about profit. It's all about making sure that our campaign contributors, well, that they're taken care of. So I find this very interesting, this whole, well, baby steps thing now. We're just going to sell off the real profitable stuff, kind of like what they're doing out in Pittsburgh with the Pittsburgh Transit Authority. They tried, they privatized off the really profitable lanes. And then the private sector screwed it up because they raised the prices through the roof, and all the people who were riding it went somewhere out to a different station. Now they want to privatize that. And you go, hold on, you screwed up the most profitable lines. Why would we give you anything else? And this is the thing that gets me. Things that are ours, things that are for the common good, for the good of our society, should not be in the hands of profiteers. The T-shirt that I'm wearing should be made by private companies, absolutely, because I could wear something else. The electricity that comes into my house, I have very few alternatives. The gasoline in the car, got very few alternatives. Actually, I have none. Which is why we need to make sure, we need to have that conversation. What should be in the hands of we the people? The Tennessee Valley Authority, another one of those perfect examples. Something we should be holding. Period, flat line, bottom done. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the first hour of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. I'm going to take a quick break, right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Seven Florida teachers are suing the state over a 2011 law that they allege is violating their constitutional right to due process and equal protections. The complaint claims that by eliminating tenure for new teachers, but not for older teachers, it creates an unequal class system in the schools. Additionally, under the law, job performance is gauged partially by standardized tests, and those tests can include information that teachers didn't teach in the class. For example, the standardized test could include testing on math topics that the teacher being judged hasn't taught in her classroom. The Florida Education Association also joined the lawsuit, which was filed Tuesday in Gainesville Federal Court. The AFL-CIO is substantially expanding its non-union worker program, Doug Cunningham reports.
Working America, the AFL-CIO community affiliate consisting of non-union workers, is expanding to all 50 states in the U.S. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka told The Nation magazine that Working America has recruited more than 3 million people who aren't in unions to join the labor movement. Working America Executive Director Karen Nussbaum says the expansion into all 50 states will also mean beginning to organize in workplaces. Working America plans to double its number of state chapters over 3 years, with the goal of having chapters in every state by 2018. Nussbaum told The Nation magazine she wants to give workers the tools they need to get into motion at the workplace and in communities. She said labor leaders have told her they need Working America in every state. Working America is supported financially by the AFL-CIO, but the organization is working on economic self-sufficiency as it expands the number of chapters around the country.
More Republic Allied Waste workers have gone on strike, charging the company with unfair labor practices. Workers in Memphis and Millington, Tennessee, stopped collecting recycling, alleging that Republic unilaterally cut wages without negotiating with the union representing those workers. According to the Teamsters, some workers saw their paychecks slashed by upwards of $200. The strike follows workers in Georgia walking off the job Monday, alleging that Republic has refused to bargain fairly over a contract. Additionally, workers in Youngstown began an unfair labor practice strike on March 27th. Republic workers in other areas of the country have also stopped work in solidarity with those currently making the unfair labor practice charges. Strikes have been reported in Washington State, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Indiana.
Workers Independent News. Workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to pee. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So in looking at Governor Corbett's Twitter page, he points out that today he was in Philadelphia to welcome Horizon Lines freight shipping company to the ports of Philadelphia. I wonder how much tax dollars, how many tax dollars we gave out there. He said the move will help create an estimated 400 full-time direct and indirect jobs at the port. I wonder how many are direct, if he's making that distinction. Also, he claims it's going to bring $3 million in tax revenue. So he's back from his trip through, Rio and through Brazil and Chile, brought 74 jobs back while we're losing, over 1,000 in Erie. Now he comes back and says, hey, 400 jobs here in the port, while he's cost us in education cuts more than 20,000 education professional jobs. And I'm looking down the road at some of the other cuts that are coming, could be more. And we've talked about what's going on in Philadelphia with the school district and the negotiations with the teachers. Just blows the mind what the school district's asking for. In fact, the numbers could cost upwards of 3,000 more jobs. So good job there, Governor. You brought in 400 that you probably stole from somewhere else while we're losing another 3,000 teachers. Great. Way to go, buddy. That's why I've asked Hillary Lirinopoulos, a Philadelphia fourth grade teacher, to come talk to us about the negotiations and what's going on down there in Philadelphia. Hillary, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I am good. You know, I'm looking at this, and 400 jobs you're bringing in, but in the school district, I've heard rumors, 3,000 could be lost?
Yeah, that was the bombshell that came out today. 3,000 jobs could be lost next year.
And,
schools essentially would be running with principals, just one principal per school, no matter the size, and the bare-bones essential teachers that are required by law. That's it.
I mean, to me, that sounds like a recipe for disaster. But I should know it is a recipe for disaster, because the way I see it going on in Philadelphia, what they're trying to do is privatize the whole system, move everything into either for-profits or into charters.
Right. Right. It is a recipe for disaster, but it's at this stage, it's unbelievable to me because I don't actually see how you could possibly cut any more than you've already cut. I have, this year in my class, I have 8 more kids than I had last year in my class. And we are getting several hundred students more next year in our school.
Wow.
Because of a neighboring school that's closing. So we're a receiving school, and we're going to have several hundred more kids and significantly fewer resources. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
How many kids do you have in your class this year?
At the moment, 26, which is actually not so bad. But we had really small classes last year, and we were able to do a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, I've got 3 kids. I have a hard enough time keeping them still for 30 minutes, let alone an entire day. I can't imagine what it's like to have 26 or 27. Or, you know, I look at that school in Detroit, Michigan, that was cited by the fire marshal for having 52 kids in a kindergarten class.
Yep.
Is
and
that
that's
where
the
we're
thing,
heading?
That's the thing that we're thinking maybe is only that will be our leverage next year is building safety code. I was telling some of my colleagues, well, maybe we're going to, you know, if they're going to cancel the class cap sizes, because that's part of the contract that they're seeking to eliminate class cap requirements. So that's one of the asks. So I said, well, maybe we can actually fight this based on building code and square footage. And it's sick that we're having to think that way.
Yeah, I mean, the sad reality is, you know, I look at that school in Detroit. There was barely enough room in that classroom for the kids to trip over each other.
Right, absolutely. Yep. That's the reality. And, I mean, with the kindergartners having 30 kids in a class, I mean,
That's warehousing.
Silly.
That's just warehousing is what it is.
Yep, yep.
And what frustrates me is, you know, I see all of this money being spent on advertising for charters. I see all this money spent on a George W. Bush presidential library, some $500 million they raised for a guy who could barely hold the book My Pet Goat, and yet I look in the contract that they've offered you, no librarians.
Right. Well, I mean, there are very, very few librarians already. I mean, that's the thing. When I heard this budget, it would be one thing if we had all of these superfluous things and we had all these extracurriculars and we had sports and we had librarians and we had enough counselors and nurses. We don't already. We have one counselor for 600 some kids, and she's required to do, high school applications, regular counseling, and she's spread so thin. So next year they're going to just eliminate all counselors. They would just be gone.
So what happens to what they used to do? It just the kids just don't get it.
It becomes somebody else's responsibility.
So then, what you're saying is it just doesn't happen.
Well, it depends. I mean, we've added a lot onto our own personal plates as the years have passed, and I think that's just out of we feel a moral responsibility to go above and beyond. And so we do, and I think that in a way we end up shooting ourselves in the foot with that because then they say, well, look, you can do that. You know, you can do more. You absolutely can. I was doing work until 10 minutes before you called.
Jeez. But you have that cushy job. It's 7 hours a day, summer's off, weekends
right.
off. It's a cushy job.
Of course, absolutely.
And you make huge money with gilded pensions and all of that stuff. What are you complaining about?
Yes, with a 13% pay cut looming and the 13% contribution to healthcare. And I was flabbergasted when I read everything tonight, and I don't know why I was. Because I guess we know the money is lacking, but I just thought surely somebody will see that you actually physically can't operate buildings like that.
Well, let me ask you this, Hillary. You said the money's lacking. Is the money lacking, or is it just being poorly allocated? Because, you know, I look at all the money that we seem to have for charter schools and for the consultants who run the charter schools. We seem to have a ton of money for that. We have a ton of money for advertising. We have a ton of money for, you know, cyber charters and all of this stuff. Is it that we don't have it, or we're poorly allocating it? Or is it both?
I think that it's both. And I think that in the district, we were really poorly managed for a long time. And there was a lot of money that was really, really poorly spent. And we were up in arms about it, and we were trying to make noise about it, but we were under a, teachers were very, very scared to talk and to complain. And I do see that dynamic shifting a little bit, which I think
so.
Is a positive thing. I really do see that as positive, and I do think that our voices are being heard more. So I think that it's unfair to say there is enough money and we just have to do a better job with it, because, you know, of course it goes back to, well, what were they doing in the previous years? They really messed us up for a long time.
Well, with the goal of privatizing it. I mean, it's, to me, I look at cities like Philadelphia or my hometown of Cleveland or Detroit or Milwaukee or any of these places where these charters have sprung up, and they've all followed the same path. They've given their tax base away. They've created and manufactured this enormous budget crisis. And then they go, oh, well, it's broken. We got to bring in corporate money. Corporate money comes in and says, oh, we got to get rid of these public school teachers because they're too uppity. We need to bring in exploitable charter teachers. And look, there's nothing. I have no problem with people who work at a charter school.
Right.
Get a voice. Stand up and fight for yourself. I mean, for me, I wish more teachers were like the image of Teamsters on TV, because we absolutely need people who are going to go to the streets and stand up and say, enough. I've got to advocate for my kids. I got to advocate for the system as a whole.
Right. Right. And that's essential. That's what I see as my essential role as an advocate for my students. And that's what I'll continue to do. I'm not out there advocating for my paycheck. I'm not out there advocating. I'm not really asking anybody to even contribute more for supplies for my classroom. I'm not, because I know that's part of the gig, and I
But it shouldn't be,
that.
Hillary.
But,
it shouldn't be.
You know, my job is to advocate for my students, 26 kids in North Philadelphia, living in conditions that if Governor Corbett dared to walk into their houses, he would probably actually be shocked. And that doesn't mean that they don't have good parents. That doesn't mean that they don't have parents that are not trying their hardest to do what they can for their, you know, their most prized possession is their child. But yet we fail them, and they have no voice, and they're in this little bubble in North Philadelphia, and nobody outside of the neighborhood wants to hear or thinks that they have anything to offer. So my ultimate goal as an educator is to expose the good, the great things that happen in this tiny neighborhood in West Kensington, North Philadelphia, you know, and to show people that these kids are actually not those children. They're our kids, and they're worth it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, it's like any of the, you know, when I played any sports, I mean, the idea of, you know, the weakest link, the one who's the weakest link, that's how well we're going to do, and how we treat the most vulnerable in our society is how our nation's going to go. If we allow kids in West Philadelphia or a kid on the, like me growing up on the west side of Cleveland, to fall behind and to fail, our entire nation is going to fall behind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they already are. We already are failing our children with lacking resources. I mean, we had a program last year at our school that was just phenomenal. A woman who was from an outside agency but partnered with the school district, and she was basically a liaison between families and social services. So we could refer a child to her for basically anything. You know, if I suspected that a child had some mental health issues, even physical health issues, you know, dental care, if I thought that, you know, outside tutoring would help the child, she could sit with that parent. She would go to their house. She would sit with them at their house. She would basically do an intake survey for all the kids, you know, see what exactly was the missing piece in making this child successful.
See, that's
and she
the
would be an awesome liaison between, and she would reach out to agencies that we're not really allowed to as teachers. And, you know, then she was gone. And that was that. And that program was no more, and the kids who were working with her had no idea where she went and
just disappeared.
Disappeared.
And that's the problem. That's the problem with a lot of poor school districts. There's no stability. There's no cohesiveness. There's no continuity. And to me, when you start pulling money out and you defund these schools, that's what you end up with. And the sad thing is these kids they're growing up in unstable environments. They're growing up in places where they don't have that consistency. And to continue that in the education process just reinforces that insecurity.
Right. And that's the, you know, there's a group of my coworkers and I have been at the school for a while, and that's one of the things that we often say that it's so, so important that the kids have faces that they've seen for years and years and years. And they have people that they can know that will be there, but they don't have enough of them, and they don't have, and I can't provide my kids with everything that they need. I can't provide them with outside counseling. I can't diagnose mental illness. I can't provide them therapy for mental illness, you know, things like that that they actually, they need.
Yeah.
And they're just, there isn't enough of. And we're already in this completely strapped situation. We heard last year from the district that they knew that they couldn't hit schools anymore, that it was just that schools were like already cut to the bone, so they were going to find other places to cut. And now I don't know how you can cut more.
Well, let me ask you last line of questioning here, and in looking at this offer that the district has made, is this just not a way to get, because from the beginning when I looked at it, I said this is a recipe to get the teachers to go out on strike so you can then get rid of all of them and charterize everything. Is there any thought that's potentially the idea behind this? Because I look at the number of things that are in this, and there's a ton of things. I can't go through every one of them right now, but there's a ton of things that are just right from the beginning, in my view, non-starters. Like teachers not being able to defend themselves, not having water fountains, not having a break area, not having desks or books or you name it. To me, it just looked like it was so objectionable that they were trying to force teachers to go out on strike.
Well, I mean, we're, as you probably know, under Act 46, we theoretically can't strike. And that's what they hold on to, I think, that under the state takeover law, which only applies to Philadelphia, we're not allowed to strike. Now, that's never been tested in the court. So that remains to be seen. I think that the initial contract offer is probably designed somewhat to counsel people into retirement or resignation, and then that way it's easier to say that they did not have as many layoffs as they anticipated. Because if people are resigning, then they didn't get laid off. That's one facet of it. And I think with the budget situation that came out today, I do think that part of it is to put the pressure on the state primarily to, you know, give the funding that has been asked. So I do think that that's a huge chunk of it, but I think that a lot of it is not scare tactics from everything I'm reading, that it's actually real stuff that could happen
and
is likely to happen and is frightening.
And what's sad about that is, you know, as you said there a second ago, you're going to see a lot of people leaving the profession.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, that's just that spiraling downward. And as I've been saying, this crisis that's being created so that they can just say, see, we need to privatize the whole system because corporations can come in and take care of it. That's my fear.
Right. And I mean, I think that we need to shift the conversation about these failing schools, and we need to, I wish the people at the top would stop saying it's all about the kids, because it seems like such empty rhetoric.
No, it's really all about the money.
Yeah, and I mean, when when I say it's all about my kids, I mean it's all about my kids. I don't mean it's all about those kids in North Philadelphia, West Kensington. Those kids, you know, that, you know, people say, oh, you do such a noble thing teaching those kids. I don't think it's a noble thing. It's my profession. It's what I love to do.
Yep.
And I don't see it as charity work. And when we start seeing educating our kids as charity work, and so we think, in other words, any little thing that we provide them is, well, it's better than what they would have otherwise. No, this is not charity. This is real life. This is our future. These are our kids, and we have to step up and stop looking at them as a charity project.
I'm right there with you. I couldn't agree more. Hillary, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the passion. Thank
My
you so
pleasure.
Much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Alrighty, I appreciate
All right,
it.
Thanks, Rick. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Alrighty. Hillary Leonardopoulos, fourth grade teacher there in Philadelphia. It's a horrible situation down there. Let's take a quick break back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Save the USA, drowning in craft and lies. Save the USA and resume the ties in mind. Stop taking all our money. Shipping it offshore to the job you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
Earth Day cometh, the 43rd year of this national focus on our globe. Should we weep or cheer? Both. The first step toward any recovery is admitting that we have a problem. In fact, beaucoup of them. For example, despite the squawking of profiteering polluters and professional deniers, our very atmosphere, without which everyone and everything is dead, is rapidly being degraded by our addiction to fossil fuels, literally altering Earth's climate in disastrous ways. Yet, as we burn, our policymakers fiddle. Let us fiddle with the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, they demand, uncaring about the vast amounts of ozone-destroying carbon that will be released by ripping open the boreal forest to get at the junk oil, or about the extra carbon dioxide contamination that will come from processing this especially toxic sludge. Also, let us fiddle with the earth itself by fracking deep underground shale to bring gas, oil, and ozone-depleting methane to the surface. Oh, and let us keep fiddling with the priceless ecology of America's ancient Appalachian mountains by exploding off the mountaintops, merely to make it cheaper for big coal to extract more ozone-killing ore. There are plenty of horrors to make you weep on this Earth Day, but tears don't bring change. That comes only from the determined effort of ordinary grassroots people to organize, strategize, and mobilize. The good news for our Earth and our own existence is that such people are on the move in every part of America. They're confronting the greedheads and boneheads, creating effective energy alternatives, forging fresh and sensible policies, lifting heads out of the sand, and producing the change we must have. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what Earth Day is about. Don't weep. Cheer the progress we've made. And join the movement for more.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Fox News alert, it's election day, and we got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
Yes, he's standing guard. No, he was actually opening the door for little old lady, but that doesn't make for stereotyping, does it? not so much. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Found this interesting little tidbit over at the crowdsourcing website, Indiegogo.com. I love this. Technology, they write, engages students and gets them excited about learning. You can help us get started. Tech to Educate is a registered 501c3 nonprofit organization. Their mission, gotta love the mission, Tech to Teach provides teachers and students in independent public schools, such as charter schools, with up-to-date technology and software to engage the student in the classroom and enhance a student's educational experience. Why not all students? Why just charter school students? We don't know who's behind Tech to Educate yet. I'm hoping to find out, but it's interesting to me that it's only charter schools. Independent public schools, not public schools run by we the people. No. The ideological schools. They say what we need. What they need are 30 iPads at about $400 a piece. They need $12,000. It's going to go directly to the charter school in Philadelphia. They are partnering with KIPP, which we've talked about in the past. They said that, you know, they've got some that they've allocated for their first project, but they want to do more, and they need new organizations, and they have volunteers, because the project's underway. Founded in Philadelphia, Tech to Teach has a tremendous group of charter schools to work with, and that number is constantly growing. Students and teachers need more technology in the classroom to make learning fun and exciting. And again, I go back to this. I get the idea that we want to get tablets and we want to get iPads into the hands of kids so they learn. Because you know what? That's their technology. That's their future. That's what they're going to need. So my question is, why in the hell do we need a group like this to only give them to charter schools? This is what's going on with education. We are dividing this up by saying, oh, well, we'll fund and we'll get things into the hands of the charter schools, but the rest of you, be damned. Why aren't we investing heavily in education? Why do we have to have these crowdsourcing events? And correct me if I'm wrong. Don't we already have a crowdsourcing mechanism for education? It's called taxes. It's called paying taxes for the local schools so our kids learn, the next generation does well, right? I mean, because I thought we'd figured this stuff out pretty well, because I think I did pretty well up until I went to high school. Thought it was pretty reasonable. And I look at this article that I found the other day that just fits right in with this. We're rebranding education. We're redoing it. We don't need public schools. No, we got charters. We've got these different things. I read this article that really just grabbed my attention over at the National Journal. And it's talking about the New Orleans school. Because you remember, after Hurricane Katrina came through, they basically fired every teacher in the district and brought in all of these Teach for America people working 80, 90 hours a week in these charter schools and these private schools. And understand that the schools are divided. The white middle class goes to the private schools that give the vouchers and all of that. And then the majority black students end up in these other schools. So they've got this great idea in New Orleans, one of these charter schools, this Psy Academy. It's a charter school there in New Orleans. They do these things called surveys, right? They give the kids entry tickets and exit tickets. So we're giving them golden tickets. Here's your entry ticket. Tell me what you remember from yesterday. Here's your exit ticket. Tell me what you learned today. And then they punch it all into a computer, and the computer then tells them. Isn't that what teachers do? I mean, I don't call them entry and exit tickets. I call them pop quizzes, and I call them tests. You know, so the teacher looks at them right then and there, and goes, oh, this is what you're learning. This isn't what you're learning. This is what we need to work on. The teacher does that, right? Just a thought. Because I'm looking at this, and it's just mind-blowing on so many levels that we're reinventing the wheel with different titles and different names. And the money Well, we know where the money's going. The money's going to the top. The money's going to the big corporations. The money's going to the advertisers. Yeah. So I guess the question is it a survey or is it a test? What we're doing is in my view, just absolutely criminal. Just criminal what we're allowing to have happen right before our very eyes. Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Researchers have learned that the toxins that make snake venom deadly can evolve back into completely harmless molecules.
This discovery could lead to new drugs for life-threatening conditions including cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure.
The toxins in snake venom evolve in a special gland in the snake's body. They start out as harmless compounds that have been doing different jobs elsewhere for the snake. In fact, a snake's venom gland appears to be a melting pot, a place for evolving new functions for molecules. Some of these molecules are retained in venom for killing the snake's prey. Others go on to serve new functions in other tissues in the body.
The idea that there are many harmless versions of venom toxins throughout a snake's body suggests a new avenue of drug development. Ex-venom compounds might be valuable because they're made up of what scientists call bioactive proteins, which already are naturally designed to target metabolic processes. And that's precisely what you need drugs to do.
So studies of deadly snake venom might lead to better human health. These scientists published their study in the journal Nature Communications in late 2012. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. For more stories about the human world, visit us at earthsky.org and follow EarthSky Science on Twitter.
Search snake venom at earthsky.org for more on this story. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Smith Show. So this afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced that the Senate was going to suspend all work on the gun bill. Since yesterday, you saw the bipartisan background check agreement get shot down in flames. Reid said he was going to hold off on further votes on the bill so that it could allow the senators a little time to negotiate. And my thought is, hoping the American people get a case of amnesia and forget about it. Although the Senate Majority Leader said he was going to bring it back at some point in the future when they've done a little more negotiating. My view, Senate's given up. And the reality is, while the Senate seems to have given up, the people, you know, the people that they represent, they have not. And that's what it's going to take. Folks in the street, people calling their office, writing them letters, The loud majority in this case, I think, needs to be out and about telling the stories, telling what's going on, telling what's happening to them. And one of those activists I've got on the line, she is a survivor of an attack. She was shot herself, along with, a dear friend who was killed by a gunman. I've got Kim Russell on the line, who is an activist with Moms Demand Action. Their website, momsdemandaction.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Kim Russell, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
So, it's a horrible tragedy. I read what happened to you, and, you know, just for background for our listeners, can you tell me what happened to you?
Sure. It was ironic because what happened to me was in 1999. It was 4 days after Columbine, and I was out with my friend Philip, who was a high school teacher at the time. So at dinner, we discussed how horrible the events were at Columbine and how they couldn't happen again. He was worried about his student's safety. He was worried about his own safety. And when we left the restaurant, we were held up at gunpoint. We were both shot, and Philip was killed. Since then, there have been 16 mass shootings, and nothing's changed. Newtown was my wake-up call. I had sort of, I guess, been living in a bubble. I think I felt safer, thinking that what happened to me was just a random act and it didn't happen to many people. And, you know, it felt safer thinking that. But what? After Newtown, now that I'm a mother of a first grader and a pre-K child, I couldn't not do anything anymore.
You know, I think a lot of people feel the same way. It couldn't happen to me. That only happens to other people. It only happens in other communities. And the sad reality is since Newtown, I spoke with someone last night who said, you know, there have been 3,300 people across this country who have been killed with firearms. And you go, that is a massive number in such a short period of time.
Yes, it's really epidemic, our issue with gun violence in this country. And I almost feel bad that, you know, I didn't get involved sooner. You know, it took Newtown to sort of wake me up. But now that I've come out of my ambivalence to it, now I understand how tragic this is, how urgent this is. And knowing what I know now, it's impossible for me to stop and let this fade away. Regardless of what the Senate came up with yesterday, we're not going to stop.
Well, I hope this enrages people, and I hope more people get active and get involved with groups like yours, Moms Demand Action. Again, the website, momsdemandaction.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Kim Russell's name. Let me ask you this, because, you know, as I read your story, I'm thinking, you know, from the mind of my NRA gun-toting friends who say, well, you know, if Kim and her friend, Philip, if they'd have had a gun, they could have fought them off. How do you respond to someone who would say that? Because, you know, I have a lot of people who say, well, I carry my gun. I would take care of it.
Well, you know, I think it's odd that people can make these assumptions when they were not there. I can say this. It was dark. The sounds I heard, I thought they were fireworks. I had no idea it was gunfire. It took me a while just to even realize that I was in danger. By that time, you know, I was terrified, and your adrenaline really takes over. It's hard to have the clarity of mind to know at that point you need to reach into your purse or your holster, grab your gun, aim it in the dark at this unknown person you can't see. To me, I think if I had had a gun in my case, I would most certainly be dead right now.
And the sad reality is the statistics are on your side in saying that, because, I saw a number of studies, and especially with policemen. The majority of policemen that are killed with their own gun within 3 feet.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, I live in New York City. You know, we had an incident outside of the Empire State Building where our trained police officers shot innocent bystanders by accident. You know, and it happens. Even people who are trained to use these weapons misfire. Most guns that are in people's homes to protect themselves are far more likely to be used in an accidental shooting than they are for protection.
You know, but everyone says, hey, that mother in Atlanta who, you know, shot the intruder 5, 6, 7 times, you know, that could happen to you.
You know, it could, but statistically speaking, that was very rare. I think what happens more often is that in New Jersey, a 4-year-old gets a hold of their neighbor's weapon and kills a 6-year-old. That is statistically more likely to happen.
Yeah, there was just a story, I think it was Tennessee, where a deputy sheriff set the gun down and a 4-year-old picked it up and shot the mother.
It happens all the time. Now that I'm involved in this work, I hear about these shootings every day. And I hear about them from all over the country because I'm now connected to chapter leaders in cities all over. So I'm getting local news from all over the place that I probably wouldn't have had access to before now. And I hear these stories every day. What I don't hear are, you know, the very rare stories like the one in Atlanta where the gun was actually used on an intruder.
So let me ask you, you know, because part of me believes our problem is our culture. You know, we've had guns pretty much rammed down our throats over the years in more numbers. Look, we've always been a gun culture. It's just been recently that, in my view, last 20, 30 years, that it's become as large of a scale as it's become. What can we do to try and maybe pull back from that? What's the solution?
Well, I mean, you know, we're trying to change the culture, and I think it's interesting that you said 30 years because it was at about that time when the NRA really changed their view and went from being more of a, you know, a teaching people how to use guns safely sort of organization for hunters to more of a lobbying organization and more tied to gun manufacturers. That's about when that shift happened. So, yes, we are getting guns rammed down our throats because gun manufacturers want to sell them. But I think what we need to do is we need to go at this like mothers against drunk driving. You know, we have to create a culture shift and really educate people about the dangers of guns and how important a simple background check is to protect us. We are not at war with ourselves, but the statistics of gun violence in this country would seem as though we are. You know, it's sad that when something like what happened in Boston happens and to think that whoever is responsible for doing that could go and get a gun with no questions asked. They could get it on the internet, no problem. And that's not okay with me.
I think a background check
is a simple, simple fix.
Right, and I don't even think it's okay with the members of the NRA. In fact, the polling say that it's not. So
I know. It's you know, I feel like the leaders of the NRA are really out of touch with their members. And I think it just goes to show how there is a lot of greed involved in these decisions.
So you don't think it has any? You don't think that it would be an intrusion whatsoever on anyone's Second Amendment right to own and to bear arms?
Absolutely not. It's a background check. We've been doing them for a long time already. Since 1998, background checks have successfully kept guns out of the hands of 1.7 million people, I believe. So, you know, they work, and it's not a big deal to do them. I mean, we register our vehicles with the state, and if we sell that car to a friend down the street, we sign a title over, and there's a record of that vehicle being moved from one person to another. I don't think it's too much to ask that we do that for a gun, which is a lethal weapon.
But the NRA, my extreme friends would say that I don't have an absolute constitutional right to own a car. They believe that they have an absolute right, even though that's nonsensical, that they have the right to bear arms.
Well, I wish that they would really read the Second Amendment in its entirety and also listen to Justice Scalia with the Heller case.
Right.
You know, the Second Amendment states that we have the right to bear arms. Okay, I don't think that gives me the right to own nuclear weapons. or a tank or missiles. And I'm okay with that. I don't need them. They're not designed for civilian use. So I think every amendment has its limitations. And we are not trying to take away people's rights to own guns. We just think that they need some common sense regulation.
Yep. And to be, and for me, it's that responsibility thing, especially that my Republican friends used to love to talk about, that responsibility that, you know, if you no longer have your gun, it's been stolen, lost, whatever, maybe you should report it lost or stolen so that maybe if it comes up, we know it was stolen.
Absolutely. And you know, Wayne LaPierre supported expanded background checks in 1999. So why this sudden, you know, change of heart? Why was it okay in 1999, and why did it not infringe anyone's rights then, and now it does in 2013?
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I've had this conversation a number of times with people, because, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I had a very different view of guns growing up as a child and as a young man, as someone who's been shot at and has seen people be shot and someone be killed and people be killed. I have a much different view now that I live in a rural setting where guns are seen more for sport and target shooting and hunting. I see the complete differences in my two situations. Do you think that conversation's being had? Because a lot of my friends who see the gun as a sporting tool, as a tool to hunt with, think, well, you know, it's just those urbans who don't know how to use guns. It's the drug culture. It's those people.
Look. Gun accidents happen everywhere. People need to be responsible if they own a weapon that is lethal. And, you know, we're not trying to take away anyone's hunting sport. You know, I'm from Georgia. I grew up with hunters. I grew up with guns in my home. But, you know, my parents were responsible with them. They kept them locked up. You know, they did their background checks. The guns were registered. You know, it was a responsible situation.
Right.
And we're not trying to take that away from people. We're just saying that with rights come responsibility, and it's for the public health safety of everyone. It's in everyone's best interest to do this, and a background check is not a big deal. You know, we've had them already. 60% of guns sold in this country already go through a background check. There has been no registry created, and no one has been knocking on doors and taking away guns. And even in the Manchin-Toomey bill, there was something in there saying that if anyone tried to create a registry, they would be considered a felon and face up to 15 years in prison. So they were even concerned and really went out of their way to make sure that there would not be a registry. So I really feel like the gun lobby just has a lot of power. They're basically just, you know, fear-mongering, telling people to be scared, to, you know, to stand their ground, when in reality, this is just about safety. This is a nonpartisan issue.
Yeah,
it's about our children's health.
So what should we be doing? I know that you're one of the leaders of Moms Demand Action, momsdemandaction.org, the website. What should we be doing? Last line of questioning.
We got to keep going. I mean, you know, one thing that came out of this yesterday, one good thing that came out of this is our membership is spiking. We had more hits on our website yesterday than we have had since we were founded. So, you know, this, we are not fading away. We are in this. In fact, this is just more fuel for us. We're stronger, and we're going to keep going. If you go to our website, momsdemandaction.org, we're making it very easy for our members to send emails and tweets to senators. We want to thank the senators who supported us and let them know that there's no horrible backlash for doing the right thing. And then we also want to shame the senators who didn't, and let them know that we'll remember how they voted, you know, when they're up for re-election.
Yeah, and hold them all accountable. Okay. I appreciate your time. Thank you for your story. Thank you for your passion, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
You know I told you once. the night that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
We're talking about the town of Rick. 1-888-520-7425. So Marco Rubio has been making the rounds. Last Sunday was doing the TV tour, did the talk at the Talking Head Bobblehead series. I think it was now five or seven of the morning shows, pimping his immigration idea. Well, today been doing the talk radio circuit. I was on with Rush Limbaugh. And Limbaugh told him, said, "Hey, you know what, polling shows that 75% of Hispanics, they think the government is the prime source of prosperity." And Rubio agreed. Said, it's a growing problem in America. People think that the government does everything. And no, that's not what we believe. There's a lot we believe. That's not it, Marco. He goes on to say, "I think we have a growing problem in this country that too many people have forgotten what the true sense of prosperity is. And he goes on to say that he blames the Republicans because, you know, they've embraced welfare and they've embraced corporate welfare and cronyism, and which is true, although the cronyism and the corporate welfare. And he goes on to say, look, you know, we haven't explained the free market, how wonderful it is. We need to do a better job of explaining free enterprise is the only way to consistently create the kind of growth and opportunity that America has always been identified with. He says, you know, we're about the true free market system, free enterprise. And, you know, I think about that and go, really? When have we really had that true free market? Well, we really haven't. Later on, Marco was on another program where he said, look, you know, if you don't support my plan, if you don't support the immigration plan right now, if you don't do it now, Obama's gonna give amnesty to everybody, gonna legalize everyone. And he points to the Dream Act. He says, quote, in fact, I think it's possible that they could give legal status like they did to the Dream Act qualificators. Qualificators, is that a word? Anyway, he says, I mean, people who qualify under the Dream Act, they could do the same thing to millions of people more. And what would stop them from doing that? Oh, I don't know, an act of Congress? Because you're supposed to do your job. And look, I mean, there's a lot in this immigration. This bill, I don't know what's all in it yet. We're still working on that. But for me, it comes down to some simple stuff. I do believe if the Republicans are going to be behind it, there's going to be a lot of guest worker visas, a lot of HB1 visas. And what that's going to mean, that's going to mean flooding the labor pool. And, you know, I've been reading these stories about the HB1s, how we need them, and how there are all these success stories. And, you know, this guy came from here, and this guy came from here, started this business, started that business. And, yeah, great, fantastic, amazing. But you came here working for $20,000 a year as a computer programmer when the people who went to college here can't find jobs doing it. Don't you have a problem with that? I do. I have a problem with other countries, and I guess it's what we've been doing for a long time. Other countries have educated their people, they've invested in these people, and then they come here, and it's basically stealing from other people as well. And look, I don't have a problem with people who are going to bring assets here. The problem with immigration is now we're going to pick and choose the winners. We don't want the sharecropper. We don't want the poor people. We don't want those folks that our policies have created over the years. We don't want those, especially from Mexico. So for me, when I look at this, I'm wondering, how many of these guest workers are going to come in? How much of it's going to spill over and going to pull us all downward? And over the coming next week or two, we're going to be talking about this because I think this is one of those important pieces of legislation we better get right. I'm sure there's a bunch to this that we don't know. Maybe there's some big fences being built, which I'm not against. Build them. Build a moat for all I care. Maybe actually talk about creating jobs. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm with you now until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Seven Florida teachers are suing the state over a 2011 law that they allege is violating their constitutional right to due process and equal protections. The complaint claims that by eliminating tenure for new teachers, but not for older teachers, it creates an unequal class system in the schools. Additionally, under the law, job performance is gauged partially by standardized tests, and those tests can include information that teachers didn't teach in the class. For example, the standardized test could include testing on math topics that the teacher being judged hasn't taught in her classroom. The Florida Education Association also joined the lawsuit, which was filed Tuesday in Gainesville Federal Court. The AFL-CIO is substantially expanding its non-union worker program, Doug Cunningham reports.
Working America, the AFL-CIO community affiliate consisting of non-union workers, is expanding to all 50 states in the U.S. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka told The Nation magazine that Working America has recruited more than 3 million people who aren't in unions to join the labor movement. Working America Executive Director Karen Nussbaum says the expansion into all 50 states will also mean beginning to organize in workplaces. Working America plans to double its number of state chapters over 3 years, with the goal of having chapters in every state by 2018. Nussbaum told The Nation magazine she wants to give workers the tools they need to get into motion at the workplace and in communities. She said labor leaders have told her they need Working America in every state. Working America is supported financially by the AFL-CIO, but the organization is working on economic self-sufficiency as it expands the number of chapters around the country.
More Republic Allied Waste workers have gone on strike, charging the company with unfair labor practices. Workers in Memphis and Millington, Tennessee, stopped collecting recycling, alleging that Republic unilaterally cut wages without negotiating with the union representing those workers. According to the Teamsters, some workers saw their paychecks slashed by upwards of $200. The strike follows workers in Georgia walking off the job Monday, alleging that Republic has refused to bargain fairly over a contract. Additionally, workers in Youngstown began an unfair labor practice strike on March 27th. Republic workers in other areas of the country have also stopped work in solidarity with those currently making the unfair labor practice charges. Strikes have been reported in Washington State, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Indiana.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
When the blew the horn, when the walls came down, they'd all been worn. When the walls came down, I don't think there are any Russians. There ain't no Yankees. Just corporate criminals.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Yesterday, nearly 1,000 Blue Mountain High School students took to the football field, left class at the morning bell to protest the expected teacher layoffs and the program cuts that are going to happen thanks to the underfunding by our governor and by our state legislature. The cuts are being forced because of the underfunding, $1.4 million budget deficit to this small school district. And we're seeing this across the country, this defunding of public education, this force closures of schools like we see in Philadelphia and in Chicago and elsewhere. And like these kids up in the Blue Mountain School District, taking to the streets, taking to action, taking to social media, saying, you know what, enough's enough already. We want good, solid, local public schools, and we're going to fight for them, which is why I've asked Dwayne Truss. He's the assistant director of Raise Your Hand Illinois, fighting these school closures in his community. Come talk to us. Also, the grandfather of two in as well. Dwayne, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how you doing there? Thanks for having me on.
I am good. You know, I'm looking at all of this action. You know, in a very small school district in a rural part of Pennsylvania, you got 1,000 kids who came together and said, you know what, we're going to protest teachers being cut and programs being slashed. We're seeing this all across the country where there's an awakening going on, I think.
Yes, it is. We also here in Chicago have the Voices of Youth that about 3 weeks ago had a protest downtown protesting the proposed closing of 53 elementary schools in Chicago.
And as I understand, that was supposed to be more than double the 53 that they announced they were closing. It was, 129 they initially announced they were closing?
Well, initially, you know, the mayor Rahm Emanuel has been playing games. Initially, they started to list at over 300 schools because they came up with this, you know, unfounded, you know, utilization formula to say that we got these, you know, empty schools, and they pared it down to 129, and then they pared it down to 53 schools, and right now you're talking about 30,000 children, 89% of them African American, who's going to be impacted by the closing of these schools. And one of the issues we point out to people is the fact that, you know, they tell them they need to close schools to redirect the resources, but it appears that they're redirecting those resources into charter schools and to the turnaround school, which is operated by a private operator called Academy for Urban School Leadership, other known as AUSL, and it's pretty much ran by venture capitalists.
Well, I mean, it seems to me the direction education's heading here in Pennsylvania. It's the same story. We're handing it off to the corporations and the profiteers, and at the expense, I think, of kids and my kids' future.
That is correct. You know, Mayor Rahm Emanuel alleged that, you know, he needs to do this to in order to save money for the Chicago Public Schools and redirect resources, you know, into poorer communities. But if you've been keeping up with this, with what's happening in Chicago, the Chicago Board of Education just announced a bond issue of $330 million that's going to add $25 million a year of debt to Chicago public school system to finance these school closures. So, you know, they alleged that there was a $1 billion budget deficit, which there isn't. It was something that was just manufactured by the mayor. And now they're going to borrow $330 million to carry this out. So, here it is, you're claiming a $1 billion budget deficit, you're going to borrow $330 million, and you're going to incur more debt to Chicago Public Schools.
You know what this sounds like to me, Dwayne? You know, you listen to, you know, when Romney was running for president, you heard a lot about the companies that he bought up, leveraged with a massive amount of debt, ran through bankruptcy and made tons of money off of consultant fees and made tons of money off of taking the money out of the companies. This sounds a lot like that. It sounds like we're saddling up the public school with all of this debt and all of this depreciating assets, the schools that are crumbling that we're not fixing and we're not reinvesting in. And then we're building this whole other thing that the privateers and the private companies and the profiteers are going to take over. It seems to me like a heist, man.
Definitely. We have a charter school operated here in Chicago, which is a political favorite of the mayor, called UNO Charter Schools, United Neighborhood Organizations. They pretty much got into the charter school business. And they received a $98 million grant from the state of Illinois to help them build new schools. But also, what UNO did was they borrowed over $100 million in order to finance the construction of these schools. And you know, when it comes to construction, sometimes there's cost overrun. So right now, UNO, you know, pretty much have borrowed the money. Pretty much, you know, their bonds are like rated junk bond status, but they sold those bonds. So if UNO can't pay those bonds off that they use to finance the construction of their new school, then guess who's left holding the debt?
You are.
That's the taxpayers of Illinois.
Nice. Now, I mean, that's a perfect business solution. That's very business friendly of you to secure their debt for them.
That is how they got it arranged, you know, with their friends in Illinois legislators, well, with the mayor of Chicago. And unfortunately, we have a situation where, again, Chicago keeps saying that they're broke, but they seem to always find money to finance capital improvements into charter schools, like, for instance, HIP Charter School. CPS spent $3.5 million to renovate a building at Lathrop School, in which it's 50% utilized, but CPS saying they got to close neighborhood schools because they're underutilized, but yet you got them spending this kind of money on the underutilized charter school. And then they're spending, they announced a new school for KIPP to co-locate into this neighborhood high school, John Hope, on the south side of Chicago. And CPS is going to spend about $6 million for that renovation. So they seem to find the money that they want to for charter schools.
And I guess that's where the priorities are. But, you know, I listen to that, and You know, what gets me is I've heard those stories so often where public dollars are taken and used for private interests, and you know, it's frustrating on so many levels that what bothers me is even politically, I don't know who my friends and who my enemies are. You look at Rahm Emanuel's a Democrat. There are a lot of Republicans for it. Obama's a Democrat. Most of the Republicans are for it. Here in this state, it seems to be a very bipartisan thing because it's the billionaire money that's behind it.
Yeah, we like to call Rahm, you know, a Democrat in name only, a dino, because he'll go ahead and just carry that label, but he's pretty much dancing to the tune of the billionaires and the millionaires. Like, for instance, you know, we got this thing called tax increment financing that the state law in Illinois allows for, where basically the city of Chicago can divert money that's supposed to go to the Chicago public schools and use it for development. So right now there's $30 million on the table for this development in what we call the River North area, which is a very well-to-do area. And the purpose of TIF is to help develop blighted or poor neighborhoods and create jobs. So here you're getting this $30 million subsidy to a developer and contributor to Mayor Emanuel to go ahead and subsidize this new construction for this new office building.
But what do you say to people who say, look, the Chicago schools are struggling. They've created this environment that all these inner city schools are, quote unquote, failing. And then they offer this wonderful opportunity where they keep saying, you know, these charter schools, they're the new thing. They're the future. We've got so much success. In fact, so much success that there are tens of thousands of people on waiting lists who are just dying to get into these things. Even though I the last report I read on it said that's not actually true, but you know, it's the talking point. What do you say to that? How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, WBEZ Radio here in Chicago at 91.5, you know, pretty much exposed the lies about this waiting list to be charter schools. Because what CPS does, they have this thing called New Schools Fund, which is basically where, you know, the venture capitalists and the venture philanthropists, you know, put money into to help charter schools start up. And what they do, they finance this major fair at Soldier Field in Chicago, where Chicago Bears play, where they bring in, you know, all these parents to say, well, we got these quality school options for you. They pay for buses. It's heavily marketed. They pay community groups and some of our elected officials, unfortunately, to encourage people to go to these fairs, and they collect applications. So a person may go to the fair, and they may, you know, not necessarily complete an application, but they may get their information taken by 10 different charter schools. And so that one person may submit either 10 inquiries or applications, and then the charter schools will turn around and say that, oh, we got this tremendous waiting list.
Bang, but there's again, 10 people.
The WEZ went to the Illinois State Board of Education website and did some research, like, you know, our mainstream media here in Chicago needs to do, and found that there's no such waiting list. And also during the teacher strike, the executive director, it was so ironic, the executive director of ICHE's called the Illinois Network of Charter Schools, as well as Warren Rangel, who's the executive director of UNO, who got the $98 million subsidy, was out there with a press conference saying that, hey, we got 3,000 seats open in our schools for those students who's out of school because of the teacher strike. So you got this tremendous waiting list that they're saying that to justify the need for more charter schools, but yet they got all these empty seats in the charter schools. And by the way, I live in the Austin community here in the west side of Chicago, and we got schools that are kicking the charter schools in the teeth in terms of their academic performance. But you won't hear that from the mayor and Barbara Bird Bennett, because they don't want to, you know, close their prized schools. That's why they came up with this scam called utilization, because they knew that, you know, that some kids, you know, bought into the color brochures and the extensive marketing by these charter schools who promised the parents free uniforms, free iPads, free laptops, and they went for it. And so, you know, they're in these charter schools, but yet when you look at their performance, the neighborhood schools, especially here in Austin on the west side, outperforming them, you know, hands down.
That's an interesting thing you brought up, to the heavily marketed part, because I just talked about a story the other day that, you know, I said, you know, how much money, I think $22.5 million the one company spent just in the first 8 months of 2012 of on advertising, and that's, you know, $22.5 million by this one private education company that isn't getting into the classroom. That's $22.5 million that I think I'm paying in taxes that are going into education that are actually just going into propping up these charter schools and these cyber charters.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, I've read a report where, you know, Rupert Murdoch and Fox is supposed to be getting into online education, and that's a big thing, you know, being pushed by Bill Gates also. Is, you know, that, and unfortunately, this is something that's been directed towards inner city urban areas, you know, poor communities in districts which serve a large number of poor students, saying that, hey, you know, we got this great online curriculum that we want to sell you, and they know that they're going to make money. You know, they set these phony non-profits up, and they say, well, it's a not-for-profit, so we're going to provide this, you know, online service. And it's going to save the school district a lot of money because basically what they want to do is just break, you know, teachers unions. Not only just break teachers unions, but as you say, profit from public education.
Right.
Because in Chicago, 52 cents of every dollar paid into property taxes is supposed to go to the school system. So we like to say in Chicago there's 6 billion reasons why, the private industry want to get into public education, because there's a constant cash flow of $6 billion. You know, in the operating budget, and then there's the capital budget of the Chicago Public Schools, which goes to new construction and maintenance of the buildings. So those are very lucrative contracts, especially when it comes to high-stake testing. One thing our organization is Illinois, raise your hand. Well, it's raise your hand for Illinois Public Education. One of the big issues we're pushing back against is all these high-stake tests. I mean, Chicago Public Schools, you may have to take up to either 6 to 8 tests during the school year, which we calculated takes away 25% of classroom instructional time.
Yeah, I just, you know, to be honest, I just opted my daughter out of the state tests here that I think are just ridiculous and with too much pressure and too much nonsense and really no help for her. I just think it's ridiculous. But let me ask you this. You know, you mentioned Bloomberg, you mentioned Murdoch and Bill Gates, and then there's the Bloombergs of the world that want to get into education. And there's this thought out there that these people are very successful. They're billionaires. Gates runs Microsoft. Murdoch runs Fox News. That these people know how to run things, so they should take over the education system, because places like Chicago have been reported, places like Philadelphia, you know, Cleveland, these are failing schools, these are failing school districts, and we need these people, these handful of people, to come in and save us.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to say something real quick about, you know, Bloomberg's, you know, his daughter, she's, I think, a board member with, we call them Stand On Children, the AstroTurf so-called group that's out there advocating for children in education, which is pretty much, you know, trying to privatize the school system. They believe these corporate, you know, driven models work for schools. Well, we have this millionaire venture capitalist, Bruce Rauner. He just retired, and he heavily invested in the charter schools. Well, one thing about Bruce Rauner, he's great at making money, but he was lousy at running the charter school. He had this charter school on the west side, a high school called, I think, the Academy for Communication and Technology, and that school failed miserably when it came to its finances as well as its, you know, academic. And, you know, CPS rather than lose the charter because there was a certain number of charters that the state of Illinois allocated, they just suspended their charter. And then what they did was, before they lost the charter, they contracted with another poor performing charter school called HIP, you know, that they get so-called national reviews, but when you peel back the layers, they're actually probably the worst performing charter school around, especially in Chicago, and they're considered what in Chicago a level 3 performing school, which is the lowest. So CPS gave that entity a contract to operate ACT, which is a failed charter school ran by millionaire Bruce Rauner. And so they gave it to a level 3 performance school to operate their school. So we have a prime example where, you know, Bruce Rauner was directly involved in operation of a charter school, which failed and still is failing.
Sounds absolutely ridiculous. So what do we do? Last question. How do we fight back this? What are you guys doing? How do we stop this?
Well, we just have to, you know, just keep organically educating people. You know, we have a great executive director, Wendy Catton. is doing great research. We got great parents. You know, we are a volunteer organization, and we have parents, you know, constantly doing, you know, the work that CPS should be doing and really giving, you know, our goal is to use research, data, and information to empower parents, because parents are the best advocates for the children, and to make sure that parents understand, you know, what's going on and giving them the research and the tools so they can effectively push back against this. And as we educate parents, you're getting more and more of a pushback against the mayor. And, you know, for the most part, he's going to be a one-term mayor.
Yeah.
And we're going to win this battle, this war, and push back against this corporate reform because, like I said, Bill Gates, he has only one vote. Rupert Murdoch, he has one vote. Bloomberg, he doesn't live in Chicago, but he couldn't vote anyhow. But it's the people in Chicago that we're going to work with, we're going to educate, and we're building up, you know, it's been moving tremendously. So we're going to, in the long run, we're going to win out.
All righty. Well, I hope you're right, and I hope more people get involved and we take to the streets and take this back. Dwayne Truss, I appreciate the time, Assistant Director of Raise Your Hand Illinois. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm going to correct one thing, a board member.
Oh, okay. Sorry. A board member.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks okay, so much. Yeah. Quick break, right
thank
back.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Right.
Stick around. Where are you? Right back after this. Thanks. That's your cue to...
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Razor Tattoos presents Get On Board, an art show to benefit autism. Get On Board features custom, one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society, Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby, Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 21st. Visit facebook.com/getonboardforautism. That's facebook.com/getonboardforautism. Sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Earth Day cometh, the 43rd year of this national focus on our globe. Should we weep or cheer? Both. The first step toward any recovery is admitting that we have a problem. In fact, beaucoup of them. For example, despite the squawking of profiteering polluters and professional deniers, our very atmosphere, without which everyone and everything is dead, is rapidly being degraded by our addiction to fossil fuels, literally altering Earth's climate in disastrous ways. Yet, as we burn, our policymakers fiddle. Let us fiddle with the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, they demand, uncaring about the vast amounts of ozone-destroying carbon that will be released by ripping open the boreal forest to get at the junk oil, or about the extra carbon dioxide contamination that will come from processing this especially toxic sludge. Also, let us fiddle with the earth itself by fracking deep underground shale to bring gas, oil, and ozone-depleting methane to the surface. Oh, and let us keep fiddling with the priceless ecology of America's ancient Appalachian mountains by exploding off the mountaintops, merely to make it cheaper for big coal to extract more ozone-killing ore. There are plenty of horrors to make you weep on this Earth Day, but tears don't bring change. That comes only from the determined effort of ordinary grassroots people to organize, strategize, and mobilize. The good news for our Earth and our own existence is that such people are on the move in every part of America. They're confronting the greedheads and boneheads, creating effective energy alternatives, forging fresh and sensible policies, lifting heads out of the sand, and producing the change we must have. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what Earth Day is about. Don't weep. Cheer the progress we've made. And join the movement for more.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.org.
I'm passionate about our economic liberty because I have witnessed our free enterprise system as it rewards the hard work of many and creates prosperity for all in this great country. And over the past few weeks, we've seen a frontal assault on free enterprise.
Once I made you rich enough to forget my name in Youngstown, in Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So interesting stories. Couple of things from Kansas. Former senator and current governor Sam Brookback Mountain signed a bill on Tuesday into law that we're going to start testing for drugs. You know, those welfare people, and we're going to start drug testing. You know, those unemployed, make sure they're not on drugs. Fact of the matter is Kansas is now the very first state in this year to implement the ALEC and Big Pharma-backed legislation. And, you know, you look at this, I ask, you know, how much more do we have to push down on people? I mean, if you sign up for help, are you going to have to prove that, oh, you know what? You're not using anything? I'm concerned about a lot of this. And why do I have to defend myself if my employer takes my job? Now, the law was passed with a Democratic Party added provision that would test legislators as well. But how are you going to test legislators if they're not collecting welfare or unemployment? I mean, it seems kind of ridiculous. But the law now requires that a urinalysis be done of any welfare recipient or any person who has their job taken from them and files for unemployment benefits. Swept right through the House, swept right through the Senate, signed eagerly. And you go, you know, really? Personally, I think it's unconstitutional. But here again, I guess they've got tons of money to spend on it as well. Also on Tuesday, Governor Brookback Mountain there signed a law prohibiting local governments from requiring contractors to pay prevailing wage. This is what's coming to Pennsylvania. Understand, it's going to. This is the goal. The goal is to get people to work for slave wages. So there in Kansas, another one of these states saying, nope, we're not going to make anybody. No more prevailing wage. Kansas repealed its state prevailing wage law in 1987, but you know they over the years they've mandated that people who use state money do. Now I look at this and I often wonder, and I have this conversation earlier this morning with my wife when we sat down for breakfast. You've got these people who make these laws. Most of them have never done an honest day's work in their lives. They went from college into you know some cushy gig and then off into public service. And there's nothing wrong with public service. But I think if you're going to vote for something like this, if you're going to push something like this, you should know what it's like to have to work for a living. And to go out there and swing a hammer and do this kind of work. This is hard, back-breaking work. And I love the people who say, you know, the market should determine what wages are. Well, here in Pennsylvania, the prevailing wage is the market wage. The market has dictated, based on all of the people who report their wages, what the prevailing wage is. And as I explained it to my wife, it's a very simple concept. If you have 20 contractors who pay a carpenter $20 an hour, and you have 5 that pay a carpenter $30 an hour, and you have 10 that pay their carpenters $9 an hour, what's the prevailing wage? And my wife got it immediately. The prevailing wage is 20 bucks an hour. That's what the market is paying for that job. And what we're saying by saying that the prevailing wage is, look, you can pay above the prevailing wage. Nobody's saying you have to pay less than, you can't pay more than the prevailing wage. It just says you can't pay less. So it's setting that floor, saying, look, you know those people you're paying $9 an hour? You're going to have to bring those up. So there's fair competition across the spectrum, and we get quality people doing quality work. Seems rational to me. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? But not in places like Kansas, not in places like here in Pennsylvania where they want to undo all that stuff. Because, you know, it hasn't worked over the years, has it? We don't have a high-skilled construction industry, do we? Of course we do. And the reason we do is because people can make a reasonable wage out of it. And in those states where you can't, guess what? You have transient labor coming through. Seems pretty simple to me. I mean, and the problem with all of this is you look at this stuff and you go, hey, what's the underlying reason? Oh, we want to save taxpayers' money. No, that's not it, because you're not saving anything. The studies that I've seen and the chances where you can look at real time what happened when they did this stuff, how did it work out, never goes the way the righties or the business people say it's going to. Always goes against the taxpayer. It's like this austerity thing that they keep pushing down on us. Now they're saying, oh, gee, you know, maybe we had some wrong assumptions. And there was another thing I saw where, you know, maybe the whole premise was off because we didn't know how to use a spreadsheet. It's the ideology. Because, I mean, just from simple common sense, explain to me how taking money out of the local economy, if you're stealing it from workers or if you're just defunding education or defunding programs that happen, how is that going to help grow the economy? By taking money out, how does it help? How does it make things better? Well, it doesn't. It makes things considerably worse. And there's part of me believes that's the plan. I guess it's cynical, isn't it? Yeah, is what it is. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with Luke Vargas from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Heft and Digger, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft and Digger, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot longer than 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig it, Mr. Hardy can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So as I said earlier today, as the Senate is walking away from the gun stuff, and it looks today like, you know, they're trying to run from this. You know, people are getting involved. People are getting active. And then look, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, you're going to want to hear the earlier interview. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and across the country. I've got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, of course. Good talking to you.
So, you know, you look at this gun thing, and again, I look at it and go, well, I guess this is the end of it, right? We tried, they got shot down. Next.
I guess it wasn't axed until today, but I think we've talked about in weeks past that this really looked like it was going to end in failure. First, you had the assault weapons ban going down. You had clip limits being taken out of this bill. Then you had background checks removed, and you're sort of left with this very weak piece of legislation that Joe Manchin and Senator Toomey say they're going to try to do something with. That's breaking off a separate bill for mental health checks before anyone buys a gun, which seems like a no-brainer to me. But, that's where it looks like this bill is now. Harry Reid says he's putting it on pause and that they're going to return to it in a few months, which on one hand sounds, like a great excuse for failure and pretty much a tacit acknowledgement of it. On the other hand, though, I wonder if the public debate hadn't started to mature as this legislative process is winding down. I was looking at this new 30-second spot that was produced by a group called States United to Prevent Gun Violence. And, I should have linked it to you before the show. It's a 30-second spot that people may have seen. It involves a man walking into an office building holding a pretty long barreled gun. And near the end of about 15 seconds into this 30-second spot, he shoots at one of his bosses, presumably maybe someone who had fired him or something like that. And he misses. And the following 15 seconds are him, reloading an American Revolution-aged musket. And it's going to take him a minute. And in the process of those final 15 seconds of the ads, everyone safely evacuates from the building. I thought that to be the kind of PR campaign to try to change the conversation on guns that we haven't heard in the past few years. And maybe things are coming around on the polling.
Yeah,
as legislators are giving up.
Yeah, I agree. And did you see the commercial, the one just like that they didn't use, where it was me standing in the background being shot by the errant bullet that didn't hit the intended target?
Sure, it was a little unexplained exactly how that whole shooting went down in the video.
Because that would be my luck. My luck would be you. Someone would come after you, and I would be the one getting shot.
Well, unfortunately, that's exactly what happens in many of these instances when there's more than one bullet per round, essentially. So I think the message there was very effective, very clear. And the question, I think, it becomes if this legislation really is going to boomerang around, if perhaps come back to Congress in a few months. Again, I have no ability to predict when that would be that it would come around, but there seems to be a potential that at least the landscape could change a little bit during that time, and that there may be a little bit more for politicians to work with. But again, it's really hard to tell where the public opinion stands on this relative to the legislative ambition.
Well, I'm looking at this, and they're going to put it off a couple of months, hoping that the vast majority of Americans who generally suffer from amnesia will get another bout, and it'll fall off the radar because there'll be another crisis that's manufactured, or there'll be another who knows what, another explosion in Texas, or another horrible thing that happened in your neck of the woods there in Boston.
Sure. An observation that outside of my journalistic capacity, but, I mean, it does seem to be that what happens so often on the gun debate is that the instances, the particular tragedies are just different enough that people don't all put them in the same, bin of analysis. And there are so many situations, it seems like, where gun control or at least background checks on people having access to weapons, could potentially have prevented incidents. But yet each of the incident is in itself going to be a little bit different. And the problem is that people don't line them up together. So I think we're looking at similar risks here.
Yeah, but being someone you're generally in a more urban setting. I now live in a more rural setting. I grew up in a very urban area in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. There are two very different worlds when you're talking about gun ownership, I think. And I think that has to enter into the conversation as well.
Right. And I think there are people who would say that it enters into the conversation by letting states decide this issue. That, however, doesn't look like it's really going to be a feasible strategy going forward either. There's going to need to be, really added provisions on guns, or there's going to just be a very laissez-faire approach, as we've sort of done so far. I don't really see how you proceed on this without more federal legislation. It looks like where things are going to happen.
Yeah. Do you see this as a huge loss for the president? I mean, I've seen a lot of rhetoric. I've seen a lot of commentary on this is the biggest defeat of his presidency, and this the end. And I don't know. I'm not seeing it as – I didn't think it had a chance of passing from the very beginning. So the fact that it met my expectations, I don't see it a huge loss. I see it as the guy actually having the conversation, so we're talking about it.
Sure. Obama, the president, had on his Facebook page released sort of a meme or some sort of advertisement that had one of those square Instagram-like photos, and it had a quote from his speech, I guess last night, saying, "We're going to get this right. This is just round one." And to some extent, I agree with you. You know, maybe we saw this trajectory happening all along, and that it's inevitable that the first iteration of a gun control bill would be shot down. But I do have to think that a lot of political capital was spent on this. If we look just at the stories that have come out about the Newtown families that have been campaigning, and they've really partnered up with lobbying firms to get them incredible access to senators and congressmen, and they've been beside the president at every juncture through this, I don't know how much longer those big public figures are going to be able to keep weighing in on this debate before people start, you know, just paying attention to them less. Gabrielle Giffords, also a figure that comes to mind, where she has an incredibly emotional connection to the gun control issue, but yet it does become an issue. How many editorials can she write that still have that same emotional value? And I do think political capital has been spent on this to a pretty large degree.
I agree, but I still give him credit for making the move. Because it's the right thing in my view.
Sure. You know, I'm also thinking about an NRA statement today that said that, you know, this is proof that Obama bit off more than he could chew. And that's something I also partially disagree with. And I'm not sure if this would have been a lot more successful if Obama had gone piecemeal on these issues, if he had considered the assault weapons ban separate from everything else, if clip limits and background checks had all been separate bills. I don't know if we would be at this point looking at a mixed success instead of sort of a complete failure like we've had now. So it's hard to really gauge the president's performance here, but there's certainly no bill in the next few months.
Yeah. The other big bill that just dropped, the immigration bill. What do you see in this that's any good?
It seems to be the opposite of you know, the politicking we saw in gun control. You've got Marco Rubio, a big political figure on the Republican side, putting his reputation on the line with this. It's sort of the opposite of, again, the opposite of what we've been seeing with guns. It really does seem to be the solitary piece of economics or jobs-related legislation that the GOP is getting behind. And this gang of eight that presented the bill today, four Republicans, four Democrats, I do think there's going to be Republican support for this bill. And it's amazing to watch Congress function on two entirely different levels at this point.
Well, I mean, for me, it comes down to they got their guest, or they're going to get their guest worker program. Cheap labor, yeah. More HB1 visas, yeah. Good cheap labor that we can exploit. I can't see how the Republicans would be against it. And the added bonus of being able to go to the Hispanic community and say, see, we don't hate you.
Sure. Marco Rubio had a press conference, or actually not a press conference. He took to the floor of the Senate a few hours ago and was talking about this bill. And the only thing he was really complimenting was the high-skilled workers, the high-paying immigration visa program that's contained in this bill. But as anyone who's, well, I guess not many people have looked over all 900 pages of this bill, and that statistic bears repeating. But there's a complimentary program for low-skilled workers, people with low-paying jobs. And that really does, when you're looking at numbers, the many millions of people involved here, you're going to be dealing with a lot more cases of lower skilled and lower paid workers than you are these highly lauded, very technically advanced and highly educated jobs that Rubio was talking about.
Yeah, and you know, some of the stories I've been reading lately about this HB1 visa program is, you know, they're getting computer programmers from all over the world. They're paying them $20,000-$25,000 a year. Well, we've got computer programmers. We've got people who do the coding and do all that stuff here. They just won't work for $24,000-$25,000 a year.
Sure, and fluctuating too. Some of these areas of the workforce that this bill is targeting just weren't around a few years ago, and it's hard to tell whether they're necessarily going to be the jobs that we need just a few years from now. So I think it's interesting. You're right that, you know, sometimes we're bringing in people for jobs that we could be getting here, but there are instances of people who come to American universities and are essentially having their tuition, you know, really aided by our own government and taxpayers, and you'd want those people to stay in the country if they wanted to. So, you know, hopefully that's where this bill is going to be making an impact.
So last question on the immigration thing, because, you know, I go back to the Bush era immigration ideas. You know, the guest worker program that they're going to set up, which has been something they've wanted for some time. Will we be chipping them? Because I remember during the Bush years, we were going to chip them. We're going to, because we need to control. We need to know where they're going. So we're going to put RFID chips in them, and so we can track them.
You know, I haven't heard about that. I'm surprised it hasn't been floated around more often. I'm sure there are some senators out there that would still cling to that. But look, the people who would want that probably wanted a border fence, like Bush was talking about a few years ago, and it looks like they won on that issue. So,
Luke, I want a border fence. I want a great big border fence, not because I think fences work, but because I want to start building stuff. I want to put people back to work. Because as soon as you build a 30-foot fence, you got a factory that props up right next to it, 31-foot ladders, or another one that builds shovels. I'm okay with that.
Right. I think we may have talked about last week. Again, building a fence often means something different than it did a few years ago. There are ways you can not only put down the infrastructure as far as a wall is concerned, but you can add to that digital fencing, essentially, added security features, and possibly the deployment of drones to monitor the border. And you're dealing with a fence that, when it can be breached by a ladder, you can also identify where that ladder is before it even starts going up. So I think that's the reason we're seeing progress here, is because this idea of a border fence is actually probably a more feasible and, a more successful proposition than it was 10 years ago.
Do you want to stop immigration problems in this country? I mean, the simplest way to stop immigration problems of people from Mexico coming into the U.S., undo our insane trade policies and let the Mexican people have their farming communities back and let them, let them have their own industry and help prop up those industries by having some rational trade agreements, not this insanity that we've got because of NAFTA.
Well, I don't think we're seeing that anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you really wanted that, it's just my thought. And lastly, I know you're up in the Boston area. Have you had your fill of misery porn? Because I can only see so many blown up things, and I can only then see the pictures of the latest suspects.
It's been rough, but I have to say personally, I was doing some radio shows on Monday, and I normally don't find myself at a loss for words, but was tongue tied a number of times during those interviews, and it's been hard. It's been rough, and as much as I try to take the journalistic separation here, I have to say it's amazing to read so many of these articles. From all over the place and posts from friends on Facebook and see names that I recognize, commenting on stories, contributing to articles and also being among some of the injured people here. It's been pretty tough to deal with, but at the same time, really makes me like Boston a lot, and I'm heading back tomorrow, to be with friends and family.
Yeah, I saw the FBI not too happy with the news media.
No, they're not too happy with the news media, and they're also not thrilled with the online community that's sprouted up, that's been dissecting these photos and contributing sort of amateur FBI-style analysis, like 4chan and Reddit and Facebook. There's some tremendous forums, which are actually very interesting and informative to look at, where just minutes after the FBI released those 8 photos today, you had people identifying the brand of hat that they were wearing. On one hand, you look at this sort of amateur effort, and you say, wow, this is an incredible way of getting information, but it's all happening in the dark. The FBI is not commenting on individual accusations or theories at this point, so it's hard to know whether these communities are playing catch-up or if they're ahead of the curve. It's interesting, though.
Yeah, it is interesting. What I found really kind of disturbing, though, is we've got this view in our head that it's going to be a Muslim guy. And when you start thinking that way, that's all you're looking for.
Sure. One of the posts I encountered on Reddit just a few minutes ago was a forum where an individual had taken the photos released by the FBI, which from my own opinion looked to be very light-skinned males, and the person had done some color changing on the photos and said that it's proof that these people had more olive-colored skin and moving it. Oh, they may be from Yemen or from other places. So it does become dangerous to start trying to meld what you're seeing into what you want to see. There seems to be a good deal of that happening this week.
Yeah, I forget who it was yesterday that said the Muslims have have they've been practicing being Hispanic? that they're trained. Louis Gohmert, that's what it was. Louis Gohmert said that, you know, Islamists are trained to act Hispanic, which I just thought was really just bizarre on so many levels.
Well, it's been an incredible exposition of the nuttiest people on earth this week, as everyone tries to comment. From the gentleman who was criticizing the Newtown families for being involved with the guns, I guess that Minnesota radio show host, to the person you just described, to CNN, to the New York Post. It's really been a rough week when it comes to honest reporting and straightforward commentary. And we're getting all the nut jobs are floating to the top.
Yeah, see, I expect a radio host to be a nut job. I don't expect a U.S. congressman to be a nut job.
No.
That's the sad thing. Anyway, Luke, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Pleasure. Take care.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Never you will look back again. We'll fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In this land we have defended from all things dark and cold. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Earth. Sky.
Researchers have learned that the toxins that make snake venom deadly can evolve back into completely harmless molecules.
This discovery could lead to new drugs for life-threatening conditions including cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure.
The toxins in snake venom evolve in a special gland in the snake's body. They start out as harmless compounds that have been doing different jobs elsewhere for the snake. In fact, a snake's venom gland appears to be a melting pot, a place for evolving new functions for molecules. Some of these molecules are retained in venom for killing the snake's prey. Others go on to serve new functions in other tissues in the body.
The idea that there are many harmless versions of venom toxins throughout a snake's body suggests a new avenue of drug development. Ex-venom compounds might be valuable because they're made up of what scientists call bioactive proteins, which already are naturally designed to target metabolic processes. And that's precisely what you need drugs to do.
So studies of deadly snake venom might lead to better human health. These scientists published their study in the journal Nature Communications in late 2012. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. For more stories about the human world, visit us at earthsky.org and follow Earth Sky Science on Twitter.
Search snake venom at earthsky.org for more on this story. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Long as I remember being bent on the down, clouds of mystery pouring, confusion on the ground.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So earlier we talked about a giant sinkhole that swallowed up three cars in Chicago. And, you know, I've been saying that Harrisburg is kind of the sinkhole capital of the U.S., 41 sinkholes in the last year. And that's my view on it. I haven't run the numbers, but it seems 41 sinkholes seems like an awful lot. But you know, when I said earlier, it swallowed up three cars, just gone. And you see the size of this mammoth hole. You go, wow, this is impressive. Well, Chicago Public Radio is calling that giant sinkhole that swallowed up the three cars, they're calling that a pothole. And you know, I guess you could go, screw Texas and Chicago. Potholes are the size of it. You could swallow up three cars. And I guess, you know, when I had done some research into it a couple of months ago, there are like 600 sinkholes each and every day in this country that don't get reported because most of them, well, don't swallow up three cars. Most of them don't swallow up a garbage truck. Most of them don't swallow up some half of someone's house and you're never going to find them again. Most of them create a nuisance. You go in, spend a boatload of money to fix them when you should have been doing the maintenance all along to make sure that, guess what, they don't happen. And for me, it comes back down to infrastructure and what we should be spending money on. And this idea that I hear floating around. Probably only one guy. It's probably just Mad Cow who has come up with this idea that, you know, we really shouldn't use the liquor store money for education. No, no. We don't want booze for books. No, no. We want shots for streets. Yeah. In fact, you could make that a drinking game. For every pothole you hit, you got to take a drink. Why not? I mean, if we're going to be funding roads with liquor, why not make a sport out of it, right? Just seems dumb to me. A lot of what goes on in Harrisburg and in Washington seems dumb to me, and it seems dumb to a lot of people. And there's part of me that believes that's by design. The design is to get people like you and me and other people who want to get to the best result to just throw up our hands and go, you know what, the system's broken. Well, we can fix that. We can fix that by being involved, by not giving up, by not saying, well, you know, it's all broken, they're all crooks, it's all rigged, because it's easy to do. I mean, it really is. I mean, every time you turn around, there's another scandal, there's another crook getting caught. Just the other day, I saw this story down in Tennessee, 24 IRS workers got arrested for theft. I mean, that is if I were a right-wing talk show host, if I was one of those right-wing anti-hater, anti-government people, I would have a field day. I mean, the truth of the matter is, there's a field day to be had. You've got IRS people who are stealing. I guess the right-wing argument would be, well, what's the story? Interesting story from Iowa. And, you know, again, you know, you got to love when honesty comes into the picture. Doesn't often, but you got to love when it does. One of the Iowa Secretary of State, who's a Tea Party guy, he was elected in 2010, a guy named Matt Schultz, talking about voter ID, and you thought that was all dead, didn't you? You thought that whole voter ID thing was dead? Oh, no, no, no. At least not in Iowa. That turn evidently going to be one of their top goals in Iowa is to put voter ID into place. And Mr. Schultz says that the reason that you should back voter ID, he said there are a whole lot of reasons that people like him and the people in this room, the room that he was talking to, care about. He says those important issues are abortion, gay marriage, and a whole lot of social issues that we care deeply about. He said, but you don't have to start caring, but you have to start caring about voter ID and election integrity. Because if you don't have that, you'll never be able to make a difference in any other issue you care about. So when I hear that, because he says, you know, you need to start telling your friends and your neighbors that you love voter ID. You love voter ID. Because his view is, look, if we can't suppress the vote enough, if we can't hold the vote down, then we can't impose our will. And we can't put those women folk in their place and put the queers in their place and put all those others in their place. Here's what I find interesting. Because, you know, he says that, you know, the other side, they cheat. So the reason we need voter ID is because they cheat. The definitive study on this in Wisconsin found the fraud rate to be 0.0002%. You've got a better chance of being struck by lightning than you have of finding someone committing voter fraud. So say what it is. It's suppression of the vote. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to...